this is John McGonigal with the Vietnam Archives at Texas Tech University, conducting an oral history interview with retired Marine Corps Lieutenant Colonel Tom Scheib. Today's October 6th, 2015. I'm in Lubbock, Texas at the Special Collections Library on the campus of Texas Tech, and Colonel Scheib is in Hamburg, New York, joining me by phone. How are you this morning, sir?
I'm bright-eyed and bushy-tailed.
Well, I appreciate you taking the time to do this with me and agreeing to participate. So, if you don't mind, I'd like to start with getting a little bit of biographical information. So, first off, maybe about when you were born, where you were born, and where you grew up.
I was born the 1st of October, 1940, in Pottstown, Pennsylvania. I moved around a little bit the first 4 or 5 years of my life. My dad was an industrial arts school teacher. My mother was at home trying to keep a handle on me. He was drafted into the Second World War about 1944. And at that time, we moved on over to my grandfather's house in Pottstown, Pennsylvania, and I stayed with them until my dad got out of the service in probably 1946. And he was with the 11th Airborne Division of the Army, and as I recall, they had moved into Japan and were near Japan and were ready to go in if the A-bombs didn't work. But since those big old boomers worked, when MacArthur was on the ship signing, the armistice, the 11th Airborne got the mission to get on into Japan, and they were actually the occupation, the first occupation forces. And my dad, he was about 6'1", 6'2", and I remember him telling me that MacArthur specifically wanted the taller guys, so that when they showed up with the Japanese, the Japanese all had to bend their necks back to look up at these big old Americans which were marching around.
Wow. That's
interesting. And after the war, my dad got a job. He was released from active duty at Indiantown Gap in Pennsylvania, and he got a job teaching school industrial arts in Palmerton, Pennsylvania, which is in Carbon County. So you can probably imagine what they did in Carbon County for a living. And I lived there from, I guess, second grade until I graduated from high school in 1958.
Well, so Carbon County, was that a pretty big town back then?
Palmerton was about, I'd say, 5,000 people. And it had a big zinc mill in the town. And there was one plant on one end of the town and one plant on the other end of the town. And the town was in the valley, so no matter which way the wind was blowing, the smoke blew from one end of the town to the other. And that zinc mill was there because zinc was mined to the south, coal was mined a bit to the north, and they did all the smelting and processing at those two plants, but there was a canal along a river, the Lehigh River, and they could barge in the early 1900s. They used mules, and they barged the ore, the zinc ore, up from the south, and they hauled the coal down from the north. So that's how she worked.
Now, when you were growing up there in Carbon County, was
elementary schools. One in the middle of town, one on the west end, one on the east end. And the elementary schools, you know, were small classes. I imagine there was 25 or so in my elementary school classes. And everybody went to one high school, which was right smack dab in the middle of town, and grades 7 through 12.
All right. Well, I'll tell
you
what.
So you knew everybody.
Well, as I figured, a small town like that, you know, there's probably you kind of run with your gang. So were there things that you did that were that you were interested in, things that got your attention early on growing up in Carbon County?
Well, one of the things, there was a small stream, maybe 30-40 feet wide. It kind of ran down through the part of town that I lived in, and I used to trap muskrats along that creek with a buddy of mine to make spending money. And there was a playground real near us, and that's kind of where we all gathered to play, you know, baseball, basketball, football, you know, the regular kid stuff, I guess. Summers, I used to get sent off to the farm when school was out. I was probably a little reckless in the days when my mother had trouble keeping up with me, so, you know, it was a good place to send me. They sent me off to the farm, and I enjoyed it. Then when I got out of the Marine Corps in 83, I raised reindeer for a living in Minnesota.
I want to talk to you about that here in a little bit later on in the interview. But so the farm, was that a family owned thing, or?
Well, yeah, there was a family-owned farm, and then there was the farm that my mother's school girlfriend, she married a farmer, and I'd go over there and help them. He was a farmer, and he was a young guy, and he was trying to pay off the farm, and dairy guy, and he was also running insurance at night, which is what ended up killing him. He fell asleep and hit a bridge, and I was probably 15-16 years old when that happened. So I was milking cows and driving tractors and all that at a very young age. Enjoyed the heck out of it.
Let me ask you something a little bit about your mom. You said it sounded like she was kind of a homemaker, but did she kind of grow up in the same area with your dad?
No, they both met in college, Millersville State Teachers College. Today they're all state colleges, but back in those days, Pennsylvania had a, I don't know how many, but there must have been 25, 30 that were specifically set up to graduate and to teach people that wanted to be school teachers. So my mother and my dad went to college at Millersville State Teachers College. My dad came from an area in the middle, of the lower middle part of the state around Gratz. And my mother came from an area up around Pottsville and Hazleton. And they actually met in college, and one thing led to another, and then along came little Tommy.
Yep. All right. Well, and so they, what made them eventually end up down in Carbon County? Was it the school?
It's where my dad got a job.
Okay.
When he came out of the service, and I remember the first year he was working, I was still living in Pottstown, Pennsylvania with my grandparents, because, and my mother was still there too, because there was no housing. You know, they couldn't find a house, they couldn't find an apartment, and it took them about a year to find a place for us to live, and then we moved up, and it was only like, well, in those days, it was about an hour away. I don't think it was much more than 40 miles by map, but, you know, in those days, 40 miles was a little, you know, it wasn't like today where you got there in 30 minutes. Hmm. And my mother, she was an only child. My grandfather and grandmother had two boys. My mother was sandwiched in between. The first boy was stillborn, and the second boy, he died at a very young age. I don't think he made a year old, and I think one of the flus or diphtheria or one of those type of viruses or flus that came through and was what killed him. So,
well, if you don't mind me jumping back over to your dad.
No, you go back and forth wherever you want.
You're talking about your dad. So he, in 1946, he got out, came back, and so there you're trying to make a family down here in Carbon County. Did he ever talk about his time in Japan or during the war?
Well, he talked a little bit about it. He was very active in the American Legion when he got back, and he was elected treasurer. And in those days, they had the slot machines in Pennsylvania, you know, in the Legion. And I can remember the big bands used to go around all over the place. And so every Saturday night, there was a big fling at the Legion there in Palmerton. And, of course, all these guys in town had been in World War II. And everybody showed up at the Legion, and it was big doings. And as a kid, I used to go up there. My dad was the treasurer. And on Sunday mornings, they would empty the slot machines from the nickels and dimes. And I would sit there at the counter on the bar with my brother, and we would be counting nickels and dimes and putting them in the holders. And we kind of enjoyed that, because we could get a Coca-Cola or anything out of the fountain we wanted, or we could reach into the jar and get a pickled egg, and the boys all took care of us. And of course you heard all the stories. I mean, the place was always crowded. They were all young guys, and you heard everybody's stories, and they were all in different services. And it was a very interesting time for me. Hmm. They had big parades. I mean, when they had a Memorial Day parade, it was big doings. You know, it wasn't like today where, you know, somebody went down the street, some old guy sat in the car, and, you know, there was 20 people watching. There was crowds on both sides of the street. I mean, they came from far and wide, and I mean, it was really a big deal. And of course, none of that exists today.
And that was the Legion Hall was in Palmerton?
Palmerton, Pennsylvania. Yeah.
And how far was that from where you live?
Two blocks.
Two blocks, all right.
I was two blocks away. I went right by it every day when I walked to school.
All right. Well, let me ask you. So when you got into high school, and, you know, you had spent this time growing up at the Legion Hall, hearing some of these stories, did they influence you at all? Were you starting to think about the military at all as a future?
I would say that 50% 80% or more of the guys that I graduated with went right from high school to the military, either the Army, the Navy, the Air Force. There weren't that many went to the Coast Guard. A few went to the Marines. I had always thought I'd go in the military, but I was headed to college in Philadelphia, and I ended up in the Marine Corps, you know, going to that school. They had ROTC, which was mandatory for freshmen and sophomores, and I enjoyed that. I ended up going into the Marine Corps because my roommate one day went down and signed up to be a Marine Corps pilot in our, must have been our sophomore year. Anyway, it was like October 1960. And so he went down and signed up. And of course, after a couple of years, I said, well, if you can go down and sign up and do it, I sure as heck can. So, you know, the next day I went down and signed up. He pulled the disc in his back playing basketball, never did go. I went in and spent 23 years. Yeah, I know.
So when you were in high school, it sounds like maybe most of your male counterparts, your friends that you were with, it sounds like about half of them went in. What'd the other half do? Did they just stay locally there?
Some had parents that were in the mill, you know, and it was a shoe-in to get a job in the mill. And the others went to college for one reason or another. And the guys that weren't going to college or trade school went in the service. And a lot of them, while we were in high school, were in the Navy Reserve. We had a football coach and a basketball coach that had been in the Navy and were still in the Navy Reserves while we were in school, and they were a big influence on us. But it was a time when the military was held in high regard, and you were almost expected, you know, to do some time. It wasn't, oh, we're going to duck it as much as we can. No, but we won World War II, you know. So.
Coming off a big high there, I think. So there's still a pretty big influence, even 20 years later after World War II. There's still a lot in the culture there, it sounded like.
Oh, absolutely. Well, when was World War II over? 46? 45, 46, I graduated in 58, so it was only 10 years out.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, yeah, it was, and so the guys that were in there at 20, you know, were 33. So, I mean, they weren't old people. They were, you know, they were still in the prime of their life, and, you know, the stories were fresh, and the social setting for those 10 years that I can remember in that town revolved around the American Legion and the VFW. That's where all the guys you kind of idolized and looked up to, you know, that's where they kind of hung out.
Well, back in high school, did you play any sports?
I did. I played varsity football for 4 years, and I wasn't good enough to play basketball. I tried out, and they made me come out every year and try, and I would just miss the team, you know. But they played for the state championship in probably 1956, 57. So they were good. I mean, we had a really good team. Just about everybody on that team went off to college someplace on a scholarship. I played football and baseball.
What position did you play in football?
I was a tackle. The little guys were the halfbacks. The guys that always wanted to be the hero were the quarterbacks, you know, and I was right up in there where I really enjoyed it, you know, sticking my nose in the middle all the time.
And you said you played baseball. What position did you play there?
I was a catcher.
Catcher.
Yep.
How about I'm going to assume it was your best, but your favorite subject in high school?
Well, I was a math major, but I guess I liked history probably the best. Some of that, though, it's kind of hard to separate out the academics from the instructors. You know, I guess I'm leaning more towards history, civics, you know, because there were various people that taught those classes, you know, that were kind of my favorite teachers.
That's exactly what I was going to ask you next, is tell me about your most influential teachers there at the high school.
Yeah. I mean, Dick Snyder was a friend of my dad's, and he was, you know, he was a history teacher, and, you know, he taught 8th, 9th, 10th, so, you know, it kind of went along with that, and, you know, I liked him, I liked the way he taught, and I liked the subject. It was easy for me, but I'm going to lean more towards the instructor than anything else.
That makes sense. I could see that. Let me ask you, was your dad teaching at your school at any time?
Yes. Yes, he was.
So what was that like?
He was teaching in that high school the whole time that I was in it. Yes, it was difficult at times.
What do you mean by that?
Yeah, I couldn't, you know, all of the things another guy could do and get away with, you know, I stood out, you know, I stood out. I was 6'1" and blonde-haired and blue-eyed, you know, and you could see me in a crowd, you know, 3 blocks away, and they didn't know who else was there doing anything, but they sure knew that shy kid, he was there. I could see him. So... And, of course, your dad's a teacher. You know, the guys are kind of giving you a rough time. I went to class with him as a shop teacher, 7th, 8th, and 9th grades. It was mandatory. You know, in those days, you had to take wood shop, then metal shop, then mechanical drawing. So, you know, and I did not like being in a class with my dad.
I bet you look back on that now, though, and probably have a better memory of it now than you did when you were 17.
Oh, sure. And, you know, until I made 25 or 26 years old, my dad was the dumbest guy in the world. You know, what did he know? You know, sometime in there, he started... From the time I went from 24 to 30, you know, he got awful damn smart in those 4 or 5 years.
I think that's
Isn't that amazing?
Typical. I think that's a typical profile.
I hope so.
Okay, so we graduated high school. Did you? One last thing. So on high school, so you said you would go out to the farm in the summertime, and you trap some muskrats, I guess, growing up to get some...
In the winter, yep.
So was there any other jobs that you did growing up in your high school days?
Well, yeah, when I had time and I was in town, I used to work at a Sunoco gas station. At night, you know, pumping gas. And in those days, you pumped gas. You know, the people didn't get out of the car and get their own. They rolled the window down and, you know, you pumped the gas and would you like your oil checked? Yep, okay, up came the hood, you know, and we checked the oil and showed them the dipstick. And, you know, it was they weren't gas stations in those days, right? They were service stations.
Yeah.
And that's why you were there was, you know, so that the ladies came in and even the guys, they didn't get out. They just rolled the window down and gave you $2 or $3 of gas and money and they'd like this much. And so I worked there at nights. And then when I got a little older, I started working in the Pocono Mountains at a Lutheran boys camp. When I was old enough to get a work permit from the state of Pennsylvania. When I didn't have a work permit, I worked on the farm. That didn't pay as well.
So the boys camp, was that a summer thing or was that a...
That was June, July, August. 3 months. So I worked there probably my junior and senior year in high school and then all through college. Until I went in the Marine Corps in June of 62 on active duty.
What was your role there? It's amazing.
This buddy of mine that I'm going to go see here in a little bit, he worked there with me too. And I look back now and I just kind of shake my head because we had a lot of fun. We did a lot of things. We were 16 and 17 year old guys and we ran a camp and took care of 300 to 400, you know, young kids from the ages of, say, 7 to 14. We would go down to the Delaware River every Thursday, buck naked, and everybody would go in with a bar of soap, and they'd get wet, and they'd soap up, and then they'd, you know, get under the water, and the soap would go down the river, and we'd get out, and everybody'd dry off, and go back and get ready for dinner. And I just look around and say, boy, there'd be some squawking today if, you know, that people saw you doing the things that we did back then.
No doubt. Now, were these 300 to 400 kids, were these troubled kids? Were these just local kids?
They were kids that came from the various Lutheran church congregations throughout Eastern Pennsylvania, the part of New York that touches Pennsylvania, New Jersey, you know, Delaware. It was just people, the churches that were in that Eastern Synod, I think they called it. I was Catholic. I don't know how I got the job there, you know. I was a mackerel snapper, but they still kept me on.
Lutherans and Catholics got along okay in Pennsylvania.
Well, you know, we did, I guess. I think there were still some eyebrows raised. I can remember a girl that I was taking out in high school. You know, she was a Lutheran and I was a Catholic, and you know, her parents were kind of wondering, oh my goodness, you know, and my parents were kind of wondering, oh my goodness. But, you know, it just all worked out. We all got along. And, I mean, I tell people this story all the time. There was one polka band in the town, and it did almost every wedding that happened. So whether you were in the Greek Orthodox Church and you got married and you went to the reception hall, the same polka band was there as if you went to the Fireline Hotel, you know, with the Presbyterians or the Lutherans or whoever else, you know. So they played the same music, we ate the same food. It's just It's just the way it was.
That's pretty funny. All right, so we graduated high school. You went to LaSalle College.
I did.
It looks like, okay. And so that's, where is LaSalle College at?
LaSalle College is in North Philadelphia. My mother wanted me there because there was a little stricter supervision.
Now, was that a parochial school then, or?
It was a school run by the Christian Brothers and the Jesuits.
So you got accepted to LaSalle College. Did you get any scholarships or anything like that?
No. That's where my grandfather and my mother wanted me to go. They wanted me to have some supervision. They wanted me to be in the dorm at night, studying from this time to that time. I don't know that we studied, but we were in the dorm during that period of time. The one thing I remember about college was I was extremely impressed by the Korean War veterans that were going to the same classes that I was on a GI Bill and were married, had a couple kids, and had a job. And I was just impressed with, they got straight A's. I had all day to do everything, you know, and I puttered along right above the minimum. I was not stretching it too much. But I knew all the places around the college to go where things were happening.
Things were happening like what?
Where you could play basketball in the bar leagues, where you could play softball, you know, Well, it was bar leagues all over the place. They had all kinds of, you know, games and sports, and I think it was just different times. You know, things were a little bit different. It was a rough part of town, but you could walk down the street. Nobody ever got robbed. There was a nursing school just adjacent to where we live. And I used to go deliver football pools for a guy that I knew. And back then, of course, that was not legal. Today they advertise on TV. You can barely watch a football game without, you know, give us $35 and play fantasy football. You know, the government gets the money, I guess, today, so. You know, all of a sudden it's legal. But in those days, it was known as the numbers. Of course, they never had any of that down Texas, did they?
Well, I don't know. They probably did. They could have invented it down here, for all I know.
By the time you were in school, this the government probably had taken everything over and was, you know, was running it as Powerball or the Pick 3 or. But back in the 50s and 60s, you would pick up the slips at most bars, and you'd fill out the scores of the football game, and if you picked the right number teams, you could win $20, $30, $40 on a dollar bet.
You know, it's something I didn't even think about, but, you know, that I've been in Philly, and I'm somewhat familiar with North Philly, and I guess I could see that happening out in that back in those days. Let me ask you about these Korean War veterans that you were going to school with. So you said you were impressed. It looked like they did a lot of, you know, obviously had some time management. Did you ever get a chance to talk to them, ask them about their...
Oh, yeah. I was impressed with their focus. You know, they had been through Korea, and they were wanted, they would tell you, yeah, you know, they didn't know when they were my age what they wanted to do, but now they did, and they had no trouble focusing, they had no trouble studying. I had three boys. None of them went to college. It would have been a waste of money. But one of them, who stayed with the Air Force Reserves in Duluth several years ago, he finished up nursing at St. Scholastica, and he's an RN, and he's working for the VA in Superior, Wisconsin. And he never would have studied, you know, 20 years earlier. But with a wife and a kid, he kept his nose to the grindstone, and A's and B's and Dean's List and all of that, and it just surprised me. But 'cause he sure didn't do that in high school.
So let me just capture that real quick. I'll come back to it about the time when you start to have these three boys in your life. But one's a nurse, one was an Air Force veteran, and what was the other one?
The other one was in the Air Force, but he was a jagoff, okay? He was a party boy. And when it came time, the Air Force told him, don't bother trying to re-up. You just walk out the back door. And so he did. And he's worked in commercial aviation ever since. I don't know if that's a good, you know, good endorsement for commercial aviation, but...
All right. And what's the other one doing?
The other one, Carl, he was the oldest. He did 30 whatever years in the Air Force, retired it as high as you can go, and he now manages a eyeglass, one of those Pearl Vision centers.
Oh, okay.
In Marietta, Georgia.
All right. Well, I'll circle back to them here in a minute.
Sure,
but,
whatever.
Okay, so you were a math major. You're at LaSalle College. You mentioned that you had, was it a roommate or a close friend that decided to go talk to the Marine Corps, and then you got excited about that. So kind of walk me through that.
I've always been kind of a competitive person, and of course now here's my college roommate. He's going to join the Marine Corps and be a pilot. Well, my dad, on the GI Bill, he took up flying and got his private's license and then his commercial license and then his instructor's license. So when he wasn't teaching school, a lot of times he was, you know, instructing people to fly airplanes, and I was one of them. And I had a private pilot's license when I was 16, but I did not like flying. I'm not a big heights guy. I did it because my dad was pushing me, but, you know, when I was left to my own devices, I did not follow through on it. But anyway, my roommate, he decided, he thought that would be great to become a Marine Corps pilot. And I thought, well, you get in the Marine Corps, I can get in the Marine Corps. And so I went down to the Naval Station Philadelphia and talked to the guys down there. Sure, we'll put you in the PLC program. And they told me all about that, told me that the next year I would go away for 12 weeks in the summer and get paid to do that, and I wouldn't have to work in the Poconos, and I could go back to college when the training at Quantico was done, and finish up, and when I graduated, they would make me a nice second lieutenant in the United States Marine Corps Reserves. So I said, okay, that sounds good to me. I don't think either my father or my mother were particularly happy that I did that. But my grandfathers were, and so, you know, that was okay with me.
Okay. Well, let's see. PLC, Papa Lima Charlie, is what you told me, and that was
Platoon Leaders. Last course. Okay. Something like that.
That's what I thought. Just wanted to make sure I had that. And that's in Quantico, Virginia, and that was
Quantico, Virginia.
And how long was that?
I was there all summer.
I went
to June. I think each course, there was a senior course and there was a junior course and a senior course. And because of where I was in school at the time, I had to take both the junior and the senior course in one summer. So it basically just blocked out the whole summer.
So was this part of a Marine Corps ROTC, or is this a separate?
It's kind of a separate way to get guys off the street. I think there is no Marine ROTC. Okay, if you're going through an ROTC program, you go through the Navy ROTC.
Okay. And you weren't doing that. You just decided to go to PLC for the summer. And it sounds like maybe that was between your sophomore and junior year.
I'm trying to think here. I went in 62, okay? And I went to the PLC course in 61. Summer of 61. Because I joined the reserves in November of 1960. That would have been my junior year, right?
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking, between junior and senior.
Would have been my junior year.
Okay.
So my junior year, the end of my junior year, I went off to Quantico.
Okay.
You know, and everything was fine until I got on the train going to Quantico, and I kind of said, what have I done?
Were there other kids from LaSalle that were going there with you?
I think there were four of them.
Now, were any of those kids from your hometown, from your high school?
No, they were all guys that, came to LaSalle from someplace else, like maybe Wilmington, Delaware, or, you know, South Philly, or, but I can remember thinking, what have you done? And the thing about that PLC, if you flunked out after college, you went on active duty for 2 years.
So either way, you were going in the Marine Corps. You were either going to go as an enlisted guy or a second lieutenant, depending on how well you did in school.
Yeah, and they didn't advertise that you would be going as the enlisted guy very, very highly.
Well,
imagine
that's,
that.
That's
huh?
not a that's not a glamorous part of the program, right?
just imagine that. They didn't really advertise it. Right.
So, let me ask you. So you said Mom and Dad weren't that excited about that.
No. You know, my dad had been seen enough in World War II, and I think they were just hoping that I would run down a different path. My mother was always very impressed with the doctors and the, you know, the people with names and letters behind their name. It was not necessarily where they wanted me in there with those rowdy, you know, type rough and tumble individuals. I think they were looking for a little more refinement in me. But it never did come.
And you said both your grandfathers were kind of behind you on this.
Yeah, my grandparents at that time were in favor of me going. They thought that was great. I had my mother's cousin was a graduate of the Naval Academy. He was one of those three-year guys during World War II and was on submarines at the end of World War II, and he was all for it. As a matter of fact, he wanted me to go to the Coast Guard Academy, but I couldn't pass the test. I mean, I passed it, but I didn't score high enough. The Coast Guard Academy is a competitive exam. There's no appointments like there is, you know, Air Force, Navy, and Army. It's the highest guy on the score, he gets the first choice. So they wanted me because I played football and basketball and baseball and, you know, had kind of a rounded background. And my uncle, of course, at the time, I think he was a captain in the Navy Reserves.
I wanted to, before I get too much further, I wanted to back up a little bit because I thought it was interesting that I didn't get this early on, but so your dad, did he use his GI Bill to get his aeronautical ratings?
He did.
Interesting. And he said he went, got his commercial license, became a flight instructor.
He started out getting his private pilot's license, and then he went and he got a commercial license and, you know, got to fly a whole bunch of hours for Reading Aviation and out of Allentown, Pennsylvania, and, you know, other places around. And as I remember, he would go fly for somebody for 2 or 3 weeks when their regular pilots would take vacation in the summer. Hmm. You know, he would do the fill-in spots because he wasn't teaching school during June, July, and August, and he got a lot of fill-in spots, and he would fly, the big Zecs down to Ocean City, Maryland, or wherever they were going, mostly Twin Beaches and stuff like that. And he kept going, and he ended up, he got his commercial license, then he got instrument rating, and then he got his instructor's license. Now, he didn't get the last 3 or 4 on the GI Bill. I think it ran out, you know, about the time he was working on his instructor's instrument license. But he stayed with it, and he really enjoyed it. But he was a paratrooper. He liked all that stuff, you know, and I just never saw the fun in jumping out of a good airplane.
He said he encouraged you to get your license. And what kind of aircraft was that you got to do that?
I learned and flew in a Piper J3 Cub. You know, the door, the bottom half of the door fell down and the top half of the in and out went up.
Yeah.
You know, it was a little J3 Cub, you know. I was in the back, my dad was in the front, then we switched, he was in the back and I was in the front, and, you know, and I had to do, it was easy, I mean, I knew my way all over the county, so when I had to do these cross countries, it wasn't hard. I was in the mountains of Pennsylvania, you know, you flew up this valley and then you took a left where you could go through the gap, and I mean, I don't think the cross countries were more than 100 or 150 miles.
I sure be driving, yeah, though, down there, right?
Yeah. And most of the time, you know, they had, in those days, they had a lot of fly-ins. All these guys had been pilots, were still flying private stuff. And they would, it was really fun because you would fly in for breakfast someplace to the Lehighton Airport, some little grass strip, you know, out along some farmer's field, and they'd have eggs and pancakes, and you'd go fly in there and sit around and talk to everybody for 20 minutes, and then they'd hop back in the airplane, fly back to Slatington or Lehigh.
Well, that's pretty interesting. I think those J3s were probably pretty plentiful after the war, and you know, Piper had to find a way to sell those things. So it's my understanding those were quite proliferated across the country, and a lot of the World War II vets were able to get their hands on those and fly those.
I don't think I ever used the radio. I don't think there was a radio in it. I was trying to think back last night. Was there a radio in there? I know when we went into Allentown, you'd just fly around in a circle out on the edge till the guy saw you and gave you the green light. You know, then you. But there weren't the aircraft out there, you know, in 1955 and 56 either.
Yeah, you didn't have quite the traffic that you have now.
No jets, you know. I mean, anything that was coming out was, you know, some two engine thing going here or there. I mean, it was a much different time.
Okay, so I'm sorry to take you back on that. I just wanted to capture that. And then, okay, so you're between junior and senior year, and you went through PLC, and now you're getting into your senior year, so that's 1961.
Yep, and while I'm down there at PLC's, there's this second lieutenant, a guy by the name of Forbes. And we're putting all our platoons alphabetical order. You know, all the A's are in the first platoon and all the Z's are in the last. And then wherever you fell in the middle, I was an S, so I was back on the end. And we had to do this march one night. We were out there, and the guy next to me, his name was Scheibel, and I think he was out of Oklahoma. And they gave us a 10-minute break, and we crawled back in the trees, and we went to sleep. We just conked right out, fell asleep, and sometime later, the sergeants are out there looking for us, you know, because everybody marched back to the Camp Upshire, where our barracks were, and when they took the roster, there's these two guys missing, Scheibel and Scheib. So that lieutenant got his butt chewed. I can remember that really well, and we didn't like him anyway. He was a little scrawny guy, you know, walked around like a peacock, and it was a very good demonstration to me how not to be when I got to that position. 20 years later, I run into him in Okinawa. He wants the job that the general gave to me, and he was really ticked. He didn't remember me, but I sure remembered him.
Wow.
So I just thought I'd throw that in.
Yeah, that was interesting. I like that. And that was during your PLC training that you got that. Let me ask you about. So you went back to what was the name of that of the post that you had your barracks at? You mentioned that. And I missed
Camp Upshur, UPSHUR, I think.
Camp Upshur, and so
at
and
Quantico,
that's on
Virginia.
Yeah, that's up.
It was those huts. It was those Quonset huts that they had in World War II.
Mm-hmm.
That's what our barracks were. There was one. Each platoon had a hut, and then there was a shower and toilet facilities in the middle of the complex. So you can imagine what that was like when somebody came through and hollered up, 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 and then you had to run, you know, SSS, and get back and get dressed and be standing in front of your bunk in 5 minutes.
So it was a little different than the camp the Lutheran camp that you were at.
Yeah, a little.
All right, and so
they used different words at the Marine camp than they did at the Lutheran camp.
So it was a Quonset hut, probably left over from World War II. You're probably right about that. I wouldn't be surprised if those are still sitting around there today. The
yeah.
and we said that was the summer between junior and senior year, and you go, so you go back your senior year and you finish school. Is there more training associated with this after you graduate, or are you just commissioned right there when you graduate?
We're commissioned on stage as second lieutenants at the end of the graduation ceremony, right before everybody got their diploma, in our little white, you know, Dixie Cup uniforms. We had whites.
Is that what they call the, is that the India whites? Is that what they call
that? Was summer, was summer service, whatever.
Okay.
You know, we had greens in the winter. Marine Corps had whites, was a dress uniform for the summer. Blues was the dress uniform for the winter, and they had a heavy greens that they wore in the winter and a lightweight greens that they wore in the summer.
All right. For
and
you.
Our shoes were brown, not black.
Some kind of carryover from the Navy Department there?
Yep. And when McNamara was in, and everybody had to wear the same kind of shoes, and the whole world went to black shoes.
So were was mom and dad at graduation?
They were, and I think they were kind of beaming when I was up on the stage.
So they had they'd sort of gotten over your decision.
Well, I think they understood no matter what happened, I was going, and it was probably a lot better off that I went as a second lieutenant, you know, as a PSC to back down to Parris Island. So, or at least that's kind of the way I explained it to them.
Well, so they were happy to see you graduate. They were happy to see that you had a future, and then you took off. Okay, so you're a second lieutenant now, and
I'm a second lieutenant now,
and you're heading back for more training.
It's the 6th of June, and I go home for about 3 days and pack my bags, and then I get on the train again. And get off down in Quantico, Virginia, and I go out to the basic school, which is officer basic training.
Okay, hold on right there. So you got 3 days at home, so you're back there with your high school friends that you hadn't probably spent a lot of time with, and you're now a Marine Corps second lieutenant, and it's 1961, so Vietnam really hasn't.
1962.
Or 1962. Vietnam probably isn't really a discussion point in everyone's home yet.
Oh, but Cuba was.
So let me ask you about that. Cuban Missile Crisis.
Yeah, that was coming in the hopper. I can't remember exactly when, you know, when that came. Obviously. You know, when you're in training, you don't look too far ahead. You know, I guess the only way I can explain it is, you know, when we were going through training in June, July, August, September, October, you know, November at Quantico, you kind of knew what was going on, but you were basically looking for the next day's uniform. Where were we going? Were we going on a tank problem? Were we gonna shoot artillery? Were we having an exam? Where were we going? Because pretty soon somebody was gonna assign us to a job in the Marine Corps.
And so I think June of 62, I wanna say that Cuba, there was probably some consternation taking place, but it probably hadn't become a crisis just yet. I don't think that would, those 13 days, if I recall, I think are in October. But there's probably still a lot of hand-wringing going on. You know, I'm sure mom and dad and friends, are they looking at you going, are you crazy?
Well, yeah, all those things kind of float to the surface, you know, after you're already there. You know, you don't think about any of that ahead of time. You're trying to calm mom and dad down. You know darn well you're not going anywhere yet, you know, because you still got three months to do in your training. You haven't done your amphibious operation yet. You haven't finished all of the tests. But when I got to California and joined the unit that I joined, they had been on ships and were sitting off of Key West while I was sitting there in Quantico going through second lieutenant school.
So things were starting to get a little more interesting once you got down to Quantico, it sounds like. So how long was the basic course?
The course at Quantico, I think, was from whenever it started in June or at the end of June. And I believe we got out of there in November.
Okay.
December. First part of December. It was a longer course then. They covered more things. They covered them in more detail. The course got shortened up quite a bit in probably 1966.
So you get the long course. That was good for you, right?
Yeah, well, it was fun. I mean, I was always in good shape. Fairly tall. You know, I was 6'1", not real tall. Nice wide shoulders, narrow hips, a lot of upper body strength. I could run. I could go up the rope, and I could go over the 8-foot wall. And there's a few obstacles that, you know, people with certain types of builds have difficulty with, but I was not one of them.
Hmm.
Yeah, I've been lucky all my life. You know, things have just kind of fallen my way, and when they did get bad, they still fell my way.
So you didn't have any trouble getting through the basic course?
I had no trouble whatsoever getting through, and I guess I was in the top, you know, quarter or better when I got out. I was higher probably in the peer ratings and the leadership side than I was on the academics. But when I graduated, I was one of the ones that they asked, would you like to go to the regulars? And I said, well, that sounds okay, you know. I don't have anything that I'm looking forward to doing, and I already got my uniform allowance. You can't take that back, can you? No. So I said, sure. If they want me to be a regular, I'd be happy to. And the only difference in that was you were in for 4 years instead of three.
So, and you're referring that because when you were commissioned, you were a reserve officer.
I was a reserve, yes, sir.
And then after you graduated basic, they asked if you wanted to have a regular commission.
They asked if I wanted to be a regular, and I said, yep. I filled out the form, and they took the form, and I didn't hear anything about it for maybe 6 months. You know, and then they caught up with me when I was up in Pohang, Korea. The guy came in and said, raise your right hand. And I said, what's this about? He said, well, we got to swear you in as a regular. We got to discharge you from the reserves and swear you in as a regular. So I use that one when I want to win a bar bet every once in a while. I said, I was commissioned in Pohang, Korea.
So let's talk about that for a second. So you went from the basic course, and your first assignment was in Korea?
I completed the basic school in December of 62.
Right.
I got orders to Camp Pendleton, California, under a program that they called the Transplacement Cycle. What that amounted to was I went to Camp Pendleton as a second lieutenant. I joined a unit that was scheduled to go overseas 6 months later. We did a 6 month training cycle, and at the end of that training cycle, the whole battalion got on a ship out of San Diego and we went to Okinawa, Japan, where we became 2nd Battalion, 9th Marines. I'll have to back up. When I was in Camp Pendleton, it was 1st Battalion, 1st Marines.
Okay.
And at the end, about the time I got there, they were getting rid of all the old people, the people that had been there for 3 years. You know, they had some people that had been there a year. They kept them, and then they filled in the slots with us rookies that had never been anywhere. So after this 6 month training cycle, we got on the ship. The MSTS Mitchell, I think, was the name. And we went to Japan, and we got off the ship, and they told us that we were no longer 1st Battalion, 1st Marines. We are now 2nd Battalion, 9th Marines. And the guys that got on the ship, who had been 2nd Battalion, 9th Marines, were now 1st Battalion, 1st Marines, and they went back to Camp Pendleton.
Okay.
And back into the barracks that we had just left.
And your job at that point was as a platoon leader?
I was the platoon commander for 3rd Platoon Bravo Company. Or when in 1-1. And when we went overseas, then I was platoon commander, 3rd Platoon Fox Company, 2nd Battalion, 9th.
Okay, so now you're in Okinawa. That's your duty station. And then what happened?
And from there, you know, we went all over the Pacific.
So you were kind of a 911 force or a quick reaction force?
You got that right.
Okay.
Just like today. They're getting back to it. They lost all that when Vietnam started. And we'll get to that too, but when in the 60s up until 1965, infantry battalions in the Marine Corps rotated back and forth the whole unit at one time.
And okay, so you were in Okinawa then, starting in 1963. It sounds like about June or so, 1963.
Yeah, I think we left. Sure, I think we left California probably around May,
okay.
End of May, and yeah, 2 week transit, you know, with a stop in Hawaii, and then refuel the ship or whatever they did take on. Provisions at Pearl, and then, you know, then out we went, and we pulled into, you know, Naha, Okinawa, or White Beach, I can't remember. But so, now we were on Okinawa.
So 2 weeks. So you're on this ship, and you get a 2 week cruise. You stop in Hawaii. I mean, this is you're still a young kid. You know, I mean, this has got to be, you got to be walking around with your eyes wide open, just, you can't even.
I'm 21 years old.
So what's that like?
22
so,
again.
So,
no, I'm 21.
So you're getting off in Pearl Harbor.
It's still, no, it's 1963, right, so I'm 22. Yeah, I'm a 22-year-old kid. Brown bar. Got a little brown bar on my shoulder. I'm supposed to know something. You know what they taught you in the classroom, but other than that, you don't know a heck of a lot, you know.
So what'd you do? You get off. I'm assuming they let you off of Pearl Harbor for a few days, right?
We got off Pearl Harbor for about 3 hours.
Oh, are you kidding me? So.
I wasn't with the Air Force, okay? I was with the Marine Corps.
All right. So you get to Pearl Harbor, even though you're there for just a stop. I mean, is that memorable for you?
It's memorable in that, you know, we got off the ship, we went down to the end of the pier, the taxis were lined up, you know, a mile long. You jumped in, five guys, you went down to Waikiki because you'd never been there. So you get out, you walk around in the sand, and you have this uniform on, you know. Everybody's looking at you like, well, what the hell are these guys doing out here like this? Okay, so we looked at that. You look at Diamond Head and whatever else was around. We didn't even have time to go over to the memorial, you know, the Arizona. But we had time to go in and get about two beers, and it was look at the watch, and, oh, we better get back to the pier. And away we go, back to the pier and back onto the ship.
So you probably felt like you were robbed a little bit of your first trip to Hawaii.
Well, yeah, I guess it was a quick deal. I mean, we were in and out. You barely got your feet on the ground on the soil, and it was get back aboard the ship and head on out. You knew what time the ship was pulling out, and you knew what would happen if you missed movement. You know, those are all the things that they, you know, they really stress to you in those days. Man, you get late, you miss this ship going, you're going to spend time in the pokey. You know, I was a little different when I was down in Sydney on R&R, and I'm looking at that big bird. You know, and it's going back to Vietnam, and I'm standing there looking and saying, well, what can they do to me if I don't get back aboard the airplane? You know, what can happen? They can send me to Vietnam if they catch me. You know, you're going there anyway. So later on, yeah, it made a big difference. But at that time, I don't know that it was. I think we were all ready to get where we were going and do something.
Sure, you've been training for 6 months, and you guys are ready to. Become operational.
Yeah, this rah-rah stuff, and, you know, we were ready to get out there and be part of the fleet, you know, the 7th Fleet.
So once you get to Okinawa and you're getting settled, I guess, so you're with your platoon, and so what's life like there in Okinawa?
Well, it's up at 5 o'clock in the morning, march to the mess hall, go for a run. I think we went out and hit the rifle range. One of the first things we did there was re-qualifying on the rifle. Got that done. They had whatever training schedule it was. You know, you worked from 5 in the morning till 6 at night during the week. And we were probably only there a month. And then we went to Camp Fuji in Japan.
What'd you do there?
More training and hiked up the big, volcanic ash mountain all the way to the top. My boss thought that was going to be really fun and spectacular. Well, halfway up, you're in the clouds. You can't see anything, just like being in the fog. But we went all the way up, had a bowl of yakisoba and an Asahi beer, and then we came all the way back down and marched back to the camp at night.
So was that like a forward operating base for you guys, or was
yes,
that just a training event?
That was another training base for us. And again, this was 1963. You know, the war with Japan had only been over less than 20 years. You know, we were still a presence in Japan. I think a lot of it was show, but we were at a spot in case we had to go to Korea, or, you know, we were available. We were always on the standby for something. Like you said, 9/11. We were always, you know, going someplace.
So in 1963, I think President Kennedy was probably just now talking about Vietnam. Is this because...
Not yet, okay? Not yet. That came in like March and April of 1964.
Okay. So it's still not on anybody's cross-check? You're not talking about it?
No.
So what's...
It wasn't a big deal then.
So what's the Marine Corps worried about in 1963?
I think they were still worried about North Korea. I think they were still worried about China.
Did you have any contingency deployments that moved you forward for anything?
Yes. While I was in 2-9, there was a good month or 6 weeks, probably March, April of 64, when we were the airlift battalion, and we got the word a couple times we might be going down to Vietnam. So we roar down to the airfield and get on the C-130s and the C-141s and whatever else, you know, the Air Force would roll out on a strip, and we got on and we'd fly around for 2 hours, not have any idea where we were, and then we'd come land, you know, and we'd land someplace else and come back to Kadena the next day. But, I mean, they went through the whole drill, you know. It's just, didn't get off, you know, in Vietnam, or you didn't get off in Korea. You got off maybe in Japan, Hatsuki, Iwakuni, one of those, and then you got back on the next morning and you went back to Kadena.
Okay. So how long did you spend?
However, in 1964, Marines were going in by company with the helicopter squadron to Da Nang. They were rotating Marine rifle companies and helicopter squadrons off of the float battalions into Da Nang. I can't remember the name of the... They had a name for it, but I can't remember that. But nobody was there more than 28 or 29 days.
Well,
and that was because if you were there 30 days, I guess you were considered combat forces.
Right, and we still hadn't made it official, at least not before 1964.
I was a second lieutenant and a junior first lieutenant, but all of the senior first lieutenants and all of the captains went to Vietnam as advisors for training. You know, they didn't do anything, but they walked around with the Vietnamese counterpart and an army guy that was already there. So by March and April of 64, we were already training the more senior company grade officers in Vietnam protocol and what was where and who was doing what. I was a lowly platoon commander, so, you know, I was not important.
But you were still, your home station was still Okinawa.
Our home base was Camp Hansen, Okinawa.
Okay, Camp Hansen. And, so it's interesting, in 1963, I think there's actually some discussion that says Kennedy wanted to do a complete withdrawal out of Vietnam. And not even 6 months later, now we're doing a fairly rapid mobilization when you look at it. So it sounds like these are things that, I mean, you're out in Okinawa. I mean, I would think that you're the force that's going to get leaned on when this happens. So this is something that you're talking about every day to your troops, your soldiers, your Marines.
Yep. Well, we were training every day for it.
Okay.
And when we weren't on Okinawa, when we were afloat with the 7th Fleet as the SLF, we would get off in the Philippines and do 2 to 3 weeks jungle training, you know, in the Philippines with the Negritos and those guys out there in the jungle, and we'd live, you know, we'd live as gorillas out in the bush and eat frogs and snakes and that whole business.
Yeah, if I remember right, the Negritos now were they did the bulk of the training for jungle survival, right?
Yes, they did.
So how long did you spend in Okinawa? I mean, it'd still be looking at your file here. At least 3 years before you actually stepped foot into Vietnam, right?
Yep. Well, I was with 2-9 from whenever we got there, late May, early June, 1963, okay? Did that 13 months out on Okinawa, and then jumped aboard the ship and came back to San Diego and got off the ship as 1st Battalion, 7th Marines.
Okay.
Okay.
And the guys that replaced you became...
The guys that replaced us over on Okinawa became 2nd, had been 1st Battalion, 7th Marines. They got off the ship and they were now 2nd Battalion, 9th Marines.
Let me ask you something real quick. When you do these changeovers, do you get any, like, do you have some time with the platoon leader that's taken over for you? Do you have a
never
few?
Saw him. Never saw him or talked to a person. Okay? The trucks are going down the road, hauling us down to the ship, and they're coming back with the guys getting off the ship. We'd wave at him, sucker, see you in 13 months, you know, all of the fancy things, but never, I think the battalion commanders and the company commanders probably had some time, you know, with their counterparts, but down in the bowels, there was no chatter, okay?
At the platoon level, there was no formal handover or anything.
Nope, we were just trying to keep everybody in the barracks under thumb, you know, because we had a bunch of guys in love that were thinking, well, maybe I ought to stay here in Okinawa, you know. Well, oh, you better come home with us.
And how many guys did you have in your platoon at that time?
Okay, let me think about this. 39. I would say close to 50.
50 per. Right.
40, high 40s. Always had somebody that had to go home on emergency leave or something, but there was 13 guys in a squad, and there was a right guide, and you had a couple of radio men. And you had a platoon sergeant, and, you know, so you had 40-some people.
So how many squads did you have?
Three.
Three squads, okay.
Three squads of 13 guys.
And then a couple cats and dogs that were like a medic, a radio guy.
Yeah, we had our corpsman, a couple of radio men, the platoon sergeant, you know, a supply guy, you know. And it changed over years. They used to keep changing the TO, but I had a lot more per platoon when I was in Vietnam, because we made sure everybody had a couple of machine guns per squad. You know, we kind of rat holed and stole stuff, and, you know, we organized ourselves a little different than maybe the way it's said to do it on paper. But
so you had a little bit of latitude to
Yeah, there was nobody coming down and giving us direction.
And when you rotated back to San Diego, you were responsible for your platoon. You traveled with your platoon.
Yep.
Okay. And you get back to San Diego, and now you're.
We got back to San Diego, and I was made officer of the day. There was a little trouble on the beach in Hawaii when we stopped.
What happened there?
I was pointed out as being a culprit. And when I got back on the ship, you know, within 20 minutes, I had to go see my boss. Well, my boss took me to see his boss, who was a lieutenant colonel by the name of Billy McCullough. He was the battalion commander. And I had to report to him, and I was asked if I had anything to say for myself, and I said, nope, nothing to say. So, okay, you're assigned to your room on this ship on the way back, and when we get back to San Diego, you're the officer of the day, and you don't go and leave until I tell you you can. You understand that? Yes, sir. Out the door I went. So we got back to San Diego, and I was the OD, and really all that was. You know, things that were going haywire, they were calling you and asking you to get them sorted out.
Sure. You were the duty officer, the guy that got called.
I was the duty officer at the end of the move. So, you know, if you waited long enough, generally things took care of themselves. But there was always somebody screaming about something.
Wow.
So you just kind of blink your eyes and say, well, we'll try to find you an answer. But it wasn't that bad, because as soon as everybody got to San Diego or got up to Camp Pulgas, they threw their stuff in a barracks, you know, got their orders, checked out on leave, and they were gone for 20 or 30 days. So it cleared out in a hurry.
And so you spent time as the OOD, and eventually I assume you were given some leave and got to go back home to Pennsylvania. Is that what happened?
Yep. Yep, I got out, and I went back to Pennsylvania, and I picked up my 1963 Corvette, you know, and took the gal that's still hanging out with me here. I mean, to see a movie when I was back in Pennsylvania. She'd been in Philly at nursing school when I was down there. We bumped into each other in my hometown, because her roommate was a friend of my brother's, and went to the high school there, and she just happened to be passing through. So, you know, went and had a couple beers with the boys, went and visited all the guys up in the Poconos, typical these stuff, before I headed back to California.
All right, so you had a 1963 Corvette, and... And somehow the timing worked out such that you found this young lady to hang out with on your leave, and that became...
Yeah, they graduated. They had just graduated out of nursing school, Germantown Nursing School in Philadelphia, and they were on the way. They were leaving in a day or two to go to California to try to get a job as a nurse. So, you know, I already had an apartment in San Clemente, and there were seven or eight guys. We lived in this complex that had three apartments, and I gave them an address, and I said, you know, you're going to be new to California. Here's an address. You can show up. We'll be back out there by around the 4th of July, so you come by the 4th of July, we'll be there, you know, and if you need anything, just holler. So... that's how that worked out.
So you make your way.
Just, you know how it is.
Well, let me just, you know, I'm not trying to get too personal here, but you end up back in California, and this young lady looks you up. Is that what happens?
Yep. She looked me up, came by with her roommate, who was from my hometown, and you know, they had a couple of dates, and they end up getting a job, getting jobs in San Diego. So, and she ended up marrying a guy from San Diego anyway a year later. But that's, you know, that's how that works out. And I was heading back to the East Coast after a year, but we'll get there sooner or later.
Okay. All right.
You know how it goes. It's kind of hard to go straight down the road without getting off a little.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So so you're out there in Pendleton. You're going through another training cycle now. And
went through a whole training cycle. I was with them for an entire year. I had 106s and 81s. And flamethrowers in H&S Company, 1st Battalion, 7th Marines. And then, at the end of April or early May, the word came down that 1-7 was going overseas. And they're going to Vietnam.
Okay, and that was in... So is
that
64?
That was in May of 1965.
65. Okay, so you've been at Pendleton between 63 and 65.
Yep, I was at Pendleton in 63, went to Okinawa through 64, came back to Pendleton 64, and was still in Pendleton in 65.
Okay, and so what happens? You get notification, deployment?
I was one of the old guys. I was one of the guys that had made the whole 3-year cycle, you know, and some of them they kept and sent back with the battalion. Others of us got sent other places because 1-7 went to Okinawa, did some more training, got rid of all the short timers, got beefed up, and went down to Vietnam. And I don't know when they went to Vietnam. I can't remember. It was probably August.
August 65.
Yeah, but my best buddy, who'd been with me through training at Quantico in the summer of 61, was with me through Quantico in 62, and was with me in 1st Battalion, 1st Marines, then 2nd Battalion, 9th Marines, and now 1st Battalion, 7th Marines. He went back with 1-7, and he was dead by September.
And what was his name?
And that was kind of an eye-opener for me.
So he went in with 1-7. Was he a captain then, or is he still a lieutenant?
He was a lieutenant.
What was his name?
Jeffrey Green. He was from Lansing, Michigan.
All right. So you went from they moved you out to the East Coast in 1965.
I went to the East Coast. I went to the 2nd Marine Air Wing.
In 1965?
And probably the end of August 1965.
Okay.
When 1-7 left, you know, they cleared the whole place out. You know, there was nothing there. They came in and left some furniture in the buildings, but that was it. I mean, they were gone. And the next guys were getting ready to go and were leaving, you know, 2 or 3 weeks later. I mean, they just started clearing Camp Pendleton out. And everybody was heading west. But so I got transferred while I was at Pendleton to 3rd Marine Division MPs for a month or two because they didn't want me in 2nd Marine Air Wing until September.
So they make you a military policeman.
Well, I went up there and fiddle-farted around. But the thing that happened was a whole bunch of these guys that weren't ready to be discharged yet, that still had 2 or 3 months in the Marine Corps, they went to MPs too. And then guess what happened in August? There was a little thing by the name of Watts.
August 65.
You probably don't remember that.
So tell me about that.
That was a riot in Los Angeles.
Right.
Where somebody got beat up and all of a sudden, you know, the town is burning.
But you're in, I mean, you're out there in the East Coast. How's that affect you?
Not yet.
Oh, you're still in Pendleton.
I'm still sitting at Camp Pendleton MP Battalion.
Okay, all right.
Waiting for my orders to go to, you know, to go to Cherry Point, North Carolina.
Okay.
And there's a whole bunch of guys sitting there with me, you know, that are going to be discharged in, you know, 30, 60, 90 days that they really don't have anything to do with. You know what I mean? You know, there's no place for us to go. We're just kind of, I don't know if that ever happened in the Air Force, but we're just kind of milling around because of circumstances.
Right. Yeah, they've had these. I think, what they call that? It's like an administrative unit where you're just in a holding area for you know, waiting.
Yep, orders. We had to check in every morning, you know. We had to make sure we were there so that they knew we were alive. And, you know, then they try to make us pick up cigarette butts, and I'd say, these guys are sergeants. You know, sergeants don't pick up more cigarette butts in the Marine Corps. They pick up their own, you know. PFCs pick up cigarette butts. You know, we're kind of unionized. But, so we're just sitting there. So anyway, we end up getting hauled up to Watts and sitting around someplace in a tent camp for, you know, for a few days. Just waiting for something to happen that didn't, and then we went back to Camp Pendleton, California.
Wow, that's interesting. I would have never thought that Marines would have been deployed up for that. I mean, it was a big deal, obviously. So did you get briefed by the, you know, L.A. County Sheriff or something to say, hey, if we need you, this is what we're going to do? Or?
Yeah, that's, we were going to get pulled into certain areas to sit on the street corners and, you know, maintain order. Of course, they thought we were all MPs and had training. We didn't. You know, we were just extras.
Did you have, well, I guess two questions. Did you have weapons and did you have any ROE?
ROE. Oh, no. No. We had weapons. We had ammunition. The strange part about it was, you know, half the guys I got are black. Okay? And it's the black section was burning down.
Right.
And a couple of these guys are saying, well, now, what do we do if they shoot at us? I said, what do you think you're going to do? You know, because about that time, racial tensions were starting to get a little bit antsy everywhere.
Sure, you're in the middle of 1960s decade, and that's becoming quite a
August
thing.
August of 1965. Yeah.
Wow. Well, that's interesting.
So, but we didn't do anything. We just sat there and then came home. Huh. And then I got my orders. And went on, you know, 20 or 30 days leave, whatever it was. And then I went to Cherry Point, North Carolina.
Cherry Point.
I was an infantryman in the air wing.
And still a lieutenant?
I was a first lieutenant. Yes, I was.
Okay. And what's your role there in the air wing?
I had no idea. I checked in there, and they put me in the inspector's office for a couple of weeks. And then they sent me over to the career advisory office. Now, I got a couple years in the Marine Corps, but I don't know anything about airplanes and the airway. I didn't care, you know? It was no business of mine. You know, they flew airplanes, went home, had their cocktails, you know, and their ice cream. You know, the grunts did all the work. We were out here in the bush fighting the war. Airplane guys, they just took off, landed, got a whole bunch of extra money. So they sent me to the BOQ the first day I was there, and I checked in. I got myself a nice little room in the BOQ. Had a bar in the BOQ called the Dirty Shame, and there was a reason it was called the Dirty Shame. And I checked in, and you know, somebody was reading my orders and said, "Oh, you're a grunt. What are you doing here?" I said, "I have no idea." Well, you know, a couple people heard that. By the time I went to my room and changed my clothes and found out I could get a sandwich at the bar, then I walked down and asked for a beer and a sandwich, and the bartender, who was a gunnery sergeant, says, "May I see your ID card? You don't look old enough to be in here." So, you know, the whole bar's paying attention. And I spy this guy sitting over in the corner that I thought I knew, but it was dark in there. And his name was Jimmy Livingston. And later on, you'll hear about Jimmy Livingston, because he ended up winning a Medal of Honor in Vietnam, a couple thousand yards away from where I was on the 30th of April through, you know, the first part of May. Anyway, Jimmy was sitting over in the corner. He went through training with me at Quantico. And then he was over in Okinawa for part of the time that I was there. But then Air Wingers decided that they should fly their airplanes like they always do, with a beer in the hand as I'm having my sandwich. And pretty soon there's beer going down my neck. You know, and I'm turning around and I'm looking at this guy. Says, "You know, you run any more of that down me, you're going to be sitting on the floor." Well, there was a big hoorah by everybody at the bar. You know how that goes.
Yeah.
So, short time after that, there was a little more beer goes down my neck, and I guess they thought I was just going to turn around and say, "Stop it." But, you know, I came around with the... In those days in the Marine Corps, they had those big cigar ash trays. They were kind of yellowish red. And so I just came around with that, and it was off the side of his head, and then things were on. And then I got jumped, and people were on top of me, and I was swinging an ashtray, and we were banging into the jukebox. Next thing I know, Livingston standing there, take him one at a time, they give him a chance, take him one at a time. And so after that, then everybody and I was friends in the bar. But I had to work my way in, I guess. They just wanted to see where it was all going to lead. But,
well, so eventually did you find a place in the air wing, or did they move you out to an infantry unit?
I stayed in the 2nd Marine Air Wing for a year. I was their career advisory officer. My job was to re-enlist first-term people with an aviation MOS. It got very easy because Vietnam had started. Money was coming from everywhere. I had a really nice boss, big old fat airplane driver from World War II, Colonel Luther. He said, "You tell me what you need and we'll get it for you." And we just put a big bullet board outside our office and said, "You know, here's the jobs that are open and here's where they're open." So guys were coming in and we were re-enlisting them get $10,000 a pop.
Wow.
Because they had critical MOSs.
That's a big reenlistment bonus.
Yeah, they all wanted to reenlist in Vietnam because everything was tax-free. So we'd extend them for 6 months or whatever they needed and get them a set of orders to Vietnam, and they'd go over there, you know, and reenlist the day they got there, and they'd get the $10,000 bonus. And the money went in an account and drew 10% interest the whole time they were there. It was one good deal.
Wow.
And after 7 or 8 months, the general and the colonel thought I was a genius, you know, because the reenlistment rate was like 27% for first termers at 2nd Marine Air Wing and Marine Corps Air Bases East Coast. But it was a piece of cake. And then I got a set of orders to Guantanamo Bay. Once that was running, I told Colonel Luther, this thing runs by itself. You don't need me. And there was a reserve colonel worked in the same office with me who was, his job was to grab pilots that were getting out and get them to join the Marine Corps Reserve. And he said, yeah, let them go. This place runs by itself. Don't worry about it with these bonuses. People are walking in off the streets. That's the way it was. So I went to Guantanamo Bay and was down there for a year.
And that was in 1966?
That was in 1966 through, you know, August of 1967.
All right. Were you infantry then, or what was the job?
Yeah, I was infantry. I took an aviation billet. There was a TO billet for an aviator in the op shop at Marine Barracks. But Marine Corps at the time in Guantanamo Bay also had an Anglico team. Do you know what they are?
No.
Anglico is Air and Naval Gunfire Liaison. So they had a bunch of cannon cockers and airplane drivers that were in this outfit already. So if they needed an aviator to coordinate anything, they already had them in this other unit. It's just nobody got around to changing the TO, you know.
So the barracks said,
we'd rather have a grunt. Because we already have this unit over here for control and air and naval gunfire if we ever need them. And the only thing I did is I understood the air wing anyway by that time. All I did was take care of the Marlog. You know, booking people on the C-130 that came out of Cherry Point twice a week. So I was the guy that booked the seats on the Marlog for the C-130. And that wasn't too bad because you just had to keep track of who were the swimmers out of Cuba. The Cubans would swim across the bay and come to marine posts, and we'd haul them out of the water and run them up to a barracks, and then when we had a load, we'd put them on the Marlog, and they would fly into Opa-locka. And, you know, the Cubans and the U.S. Embassy and people would meet them there, and they would get integrated into the Miami community.
I'll be darned.
Yeah, it was interesting times, really. So the barracks, they were happy that I was there because I was they made me an OD every third day. You know, there were three of us, and all we did was rotate being officer of the day. and we were on about 26 or 27 hours at a time. So we overlapped each other.
And I'm looking at the timeline, so 1966, 67, so you're probably about ready to pin on captain, aren't you?
I made captain just before I went to Guantanamo Bay.
Okay, so you're a captain down here. All right. From here, I see 19 August 67. I think we're getting close to our. You're a couple months away from 1st Battalion, 3rd Marines in Vietnam.
Yes, I was.
So. Tell you what. So what happened when you leave Gitmo? Where are you going from there?
Vietnam.
Okay.
1st Battalion, 3rd Marines.
Okay. So
I already had orders to them.
Oh yeah. So it was like a follow-on. We'll send you to Gitmo, and then we're going to send you to
yeah.
1st Battalion, 3rd Marines.
I was actually still working for the wing. The second wing at Guantanamo Bay, okay? I was TAD down there for a year. You know, I was supposed to go 90 days. Well, they sent me a new set of orders every 90 days.
Okay. So that wasn't
okay,
PCS.
That's kind of illegal, but I don't think anybody really cared. You know? They just didn't want to move people back and forth. And the wing, they didn't want anybody down there. They wanted every pilot they had at their bases training to go overseas to Vietnam. They didn't want any pilots sitting in these admin positions, you know, with grunt outfits and barracks, and you know, they wanted them all heading to 1st and 3rd Marine Air Wings at Da Nang.
Okay, I got you. So you maintain your position there at Cherry Point, but they sent you down temporary duty down to Gitmo, which lasted for a year.
Yep, I did 90 days of the way. I never went back to Cherry Point. They just sent another set of orders down on the Marlock.
That was your farewell.
Well, you know, hey, that's I actually stayed there a little longer than I should have, because the CO of the Marine Barracks was a bird colonel by the name of Jerry Russell, and he was retired. So he did not want me leaving Guantanamo Bay until he retired, because he had two dogs and his household furniture, you know, and all of these other things, including his wife, who was coming down for the retirement ceremony. And the only thing in and out of Guantanamo Bay was that Marine Corps Marlog, or every once in a while a Navy flight. So, you know, I kind of held the keys to in and out, and the coordination with the general and Colonel Luther and everybody back at Cherry Point, North Carolina. So, old Russell, he didn't want me going anywhere until after he left.
So
he wanted to make sure his dogs, you know, got on and didn't get nailed by customs someplace, you know. So we had to do a little talking to the pilots, and they, you know, they don't really care.
So you had a pretty critical position there at Gitmo, it sounds like.
Well, for that last month, I did. It's amazing how important you become when certain things happen, you know?
Yeah. All right, well, I'll tell you what, Colonel Scheib, let's do this. It's, we're just about out of our two-hour block, and we're in a good spot, I think, to stop and begin our Vietnam discussion, which I think is going to consume a big part of the rest of this interview. And so maybe we could knock it off here, and we'll pick it up at the same time on Thursday. Is that going to be good for you?
That's good. 10 o'clock on Thursday, I'll be here.
Okay, hold on.
I hope.
I'm going to end this recording here. Okay, this is John McGonigal with the Vietnam Archives at Texas Tech University, conducting an oral history with retired Marine Corps Lieutenant Colonel Tom Scheib. Colonel Scheib's calling from Hamburg, New York. Today is October 8th, 2015. I'm in the Special Collections Library on campus at Texas Tech. And like I said, Colonel Scheib is calling me, or is on the phone with me. How are you this morning, sir?
I'm very good, John. Thank you.
Excellent. All right. So we left our previous discussion at Gitmo. In that time, you got orders to be part of 1-3, so you transitioned over to Okinawa and helped load all your gear, and then you headed on a flight to Da Nang in October of 1967. So I was wondering if we could start right there with that flight into Da Nang, if you could just tell me what that was like. Who was on the aircraft with you? What was the feeling on the aircraft? That type.
Okay, well, we got on, I got on, I believe it was a Continental Airlines out of Kadena, Okinawa. I can't remember the type of aircraft, but it was a commercial. Regular stewardesses, and the airplane was packed with a whole bunch of privates and PFCs in the Marine Corps, a few Navy corpsmen, and a couple officers, and we all headed into Da Nang. Most everybody on that aircraft was a little bit antsy, particularly the young guys, because, you know, they just came right out of Camp Pendleton and basic infantry training, and now they were going in for the real deal. Some of the more senior enlisted and officers had been in the Marine Corps a while, and it, you know, it was just kind of another, oh, here we go again, admin processing, stand in line, wait till your name's called, that kind of stuff. And, you know, we were pretty much aware of what we were going into. The junior officers were obviously a bit nervous because up until now, they hadn't been tasked with leading anybody or doing anything other than training at Quantico, and now the real deal was upon them. So there was a whole bunch of mixed emotions, and the aircraft was actually pretty quiet. The closer we got to Da Nang, the quieter the airplane became, and then it was just kind of everybody had their eyes wide open. Because people giving briefs that came on the airplane rattled things off because they'd been doing it, you know, for 2 years or whatever. Mm-hmm. And there wasn't a whole lot of care taken as to specifics to these poor kids that really had no idea where they were going. And when I talked to some of my guys later on about it, they said, you know, we thought somebody'd be there with a brass band when we got in, and we'd be welcomed, and we'd be herded around and shuffled, and it was really nothing like that. It was, get off the airplane, you guys form over there, somebody will tell you where to go, and you get moving when you get there. So it was a lot more like boot camp than it was welcome to the United States Marine Corps Combat Force, you know, in Vietnam.
So, you know, it's interesting, I didn't think of that until I was just listening to it. You were actually kind of the old guy on this thing, I guess, because you'd already been in the Marine Corps for a bit. This wasn't your first rodeo.
No, it wasn't, and it was, we always laugh about it at reunions now, because if it was October the 1st, 1967, I just turned 27 years old. And of course, I'm 75 now, and I look back and say, 27, gee, what a snot-nosed kid. Yet, when I was there, and I joined both of those rifle companies, I was referred to as the old man. And, it's just kind of funny that at 27, somebody's calling you the old man. But you were basically 10 years older than 95% of the people that you were dealing with. Corporals and sergeants were 21 maybe, and you know, the gunny, he was up there, he was probably my age or older.
kind of talked a little bit when you got on the ramp and all the shuffling back and forth. How did you actually get from the ramp to your new unit?
I got off the ramp of the aircraft and went into the terminal. I don't remember too much about that. To me, it was just, you know, another military terminal like Kadena, you know. And there were some phones along the wall, and I'd been stationed in the second wing while I was at Guantanamo Bay in the year prior to that, so I knew some guys over in Da Nang that were in aviation supply. So I kind of jiggled them up on the phone, and one of them, Floyd Dufour, WO3, came over and picked me up and told me he had a place where I could stay for the night in his hooch, and that the next day they'd start me, you know, going north. So that first night I sat around with a bunch of guys that I was stationed with at the 2nd Marine Air Wing in Cherry Point. We had a couple of beers and I had a good meal. And early the next morning, I was taken over by one of their vehicles over to a terminal where the helicopters were. And I walked in and I checked in to the flight guy. And he said, okay, we got a bird, you know, going to Quang Tri, which is where I was headed. In a few minutes, I got on the bird and away we went. You being a helicopter driver, you understand that. We sat in the back and heard wop, 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 wop all the way and things shaking. And looking out the window, Vietnam to me, looking out the window didn't look any different than when we were down in Taiwan or the Philippines or Japan or Korea or South Korea. So, you know, you're just kind of getting honed in again, getting used to the smell. Getting used to seeing the dirt roads and, you know, the vehicles and people walking along the sides of the roads. And then we got into Quang Tri. Once again, I didn't go in. They sat down. I didn't go any further than the terminal. I showed them my orders, said I'm going to 1-3. I'm trying to remember the name of the ship that we were on. It was probably the Paul Revere. And so they said, well, we'll have a bird from the Paul Revere in here, you know, sometime in an hour or so. So I just sat around, got on that bird, out we went, and I got off, and now I'm reporting to BLT-13 aboard the USS Paul Revere.
Wow. Planes, trains, and automobiles, huh?
Yep.
Okay, so you're in your unit. You're kind of getting settled. We talked a little bit about this on the previous discussion, but I'm just curious. So when you start getting mail and writing letters home, I'm just kind of curious, what mom and dad, are they, they're on pins and needles, I guess, watching TV every night?
I suppose they probably were. I purposely tried not to say too much in a letter that they might not understand and be thinking about. And it was a lot easier, you know, just like when you're a kid in college, to say everything's going well, I'm studying, I'm doing this, I'm doing that, than to say, boy, I'm out here having a great time, having a couple of beers when I'm only 18. So, you know, I kind of took the same tack. Everything's fine. Things are good. We're out here aboard the ship just bouncing around in the ocean, eating good. And I did that through the whole tour. I didn't try to get them too excited.
All right. I'm going to remember this. This when you when we get out of Vietnam and you go home for the first time. And I want to ask you a little about that, so I made a little note here. I'll circle back.
Sure.
Okay, so you're out on the ship. You're with your new organization. You're meeting your let's see. Did you go in as a company or platoon leader? A company commander?
I was a captain. Generally, what they do, the Marine Corps does, when you come in a new unit, if you're company grade guy like I was, instead of sending you right down to the company, they'll give you a staff job in the battalion headquarters. They sent me to the S2 shop, the Marine Corps lingo, that's in the intelligence section.
Right.
And so you hang around there for a little bit of time, trying to get your feet on the ground, see how they run things, listen to what's going on, watch the major who's the operations officer, planning the events, trying to understand how he picks who's going where, how he comes up with the formations, how they determine various missions and objectives, and watching what goes on, or actually what comes down from the higher headquarters. The guys with the big hands on the little map, you know, you will go from point A to point B, and you'll cover this territory in this amount of time. It's pretty easy on the map, probably not too bad even in a helicopter. But, you know, when you got your feet on the ground, sometimes it doesn't go quite as easily. So you're watching the mechanics of all this, and you're saying, okay, I got the picture now. And we were out on a couple operations. We went ashore. I think when I was with 1-3, I was out there for maybe a week, and then they flew in and took place in participated in Medina.
Okay, good. I was going to ask you about that.
I think most of the time we were probably sitting there in reserves. I was with the battalion CP group, so the way a Marine battalion worked at those times, there were four companies, and one was up on the top left, one was on the top right, lower left and lower right, and the battalion CP group, all the heavy hitters, all the rank, was right in the middle, you know. So it was, everybody was all around us, and then and the whole outfit moved together at one time. So, you know, it was pretty simple, really. And fortunately, you know, the battalion was in reserve. There was a NVA assault that I remember on Charlie Company, who that was on one of the flanks, and you know, they got a couple guys that were sleeping and in a sleeping bag, and which is a good thing to learn when you're a young captain. Okay, this is what happened to these guys. That's why they're not going home. And when you get your own outfit, you remember these things that you saw, and you try to stress them, you know, to the kids that have never been in this before.
So I actually read a book a long time ago called The Lions of Medina, and it talks a little bit about that operation. If I remember right, that was pretty early in October, so you hadn't even had your feet on the ground very long, and here you are part of this assault that I think was about 2 weeks long or something, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I was there, I think, probably a few days, and then we went ashore, and then we were in Medina. You know, and from Medina, we went to another one, you know, Liberty or Fremont or something, which was mostly, I think they were mostly sniping at us from long distance, you know, and then you moved into another one, Granite. And I think during that period of time, the battalion lost about 14 KIAs and about 70 WIAs. You know, but it's an eye-opener for people that had never been in this type of environment before, and, you know, all the John Wayne stuff goes out the window.
So when did you start that transition from the battalion into intelligence, or I'm sorry, the S2 office to down to your company that you'd be assigned with?
I recall I went to Bravo Company on the 5th of November. So I went through those operations with the battalion when they went ashore, for the month of October, and sometime after Granite was over, then I got moved over to Bravo Company as the CO. And then shortly after that, we went back into the Kentucky operational area. And again, I think because we were the Special Landing Force Alpha, I think we were moved back into reserve because, as you had mentioned yesterday, that put us back in the 911 responder outfit.
Right.
And as you well know, there's always somebody sitting back there, locked and loaded, ready to go in case another outbreak comes here, there, or someplace else.
I think we call that today the Quick Reaction Force. It may have been. I think it goes through a lot of name changes every 10 years, I guess, but that may have been what they called it back then.
Well, I have to change the signs, get the sign painter something to do, change the terminology.
So when you went to Bravo Company, was that your first time as a company commander?
It was the first time as a company commander. Until that point in time, I'd only been a captain, I don't know, maybe 8 months, 9 months. And I think I got promoted, probably right before I went down to Gitmo. And of course, down there, I was in the headquarters. I was the air officer for the barracks and did jobs like that. And it gives you background. And the wing tour for me was one of the most educational tours that I ever did, because when I got to Vietnam, I knew people that had been in the air wing. I knew guys that were my support up above. And when they know your name on the ground, it makes an awful lot of difference.
Well, I was just going to ask you, I bet that month-long indoc they did on you, I bet it gave you some incredible situational awareness.
Yep, sure did.
Did you find that useful when you had to call in air support or artillery?
Oh, very much so. You knew from the battalion and regimental level what they were going to do, how they were looking at things. A lot, and you really learned what you needed to say if you wanted to get something. If you just kind of took it as routine, they took it as routine, and you went to the bottom of the list. If you made it sound a little more important, you were probably a little higher on the list.
I guess it
was more I learned how to play the game. In case I needed John McGonigal's, helicopter, I didn't call it to move sea rations. I called it because we needed something else.
So I just want to go back just for a second. So your first company command, and really your first combat. You're leading these young kids in there. How did that feel? I know that had to have been a little bit of a daunting task at first.
Well, it was something that I thought about, but it wasn't anything that I worried about. I looked around, and I had an XO that I had to keep my eyes on. He'd been there a long time. He was a bit disappointed, that this new guy came in and took over the company when he could have been the company commander as a pretty senior first lieutenant. So, he kind of had to keep an eye on that. And the second lieutenants were all brand new, still full of rah-rah, high-diddle-diddle up the middle, which is not what you want when you're in Vietnam. When some sniper takes a shot at you and you send people into the woods to try and find them in a rush, generally there's something waiting for you when you get into the thick stuff. And you know, you just don't want to get sucked into an ambush. And I also learned that Vietnam Marine Corps participation had been going on since March of 1965, and a lot of guys were coming back for their second tour, and we still hadn't won the war. You know, and I was able to see that, well, this is going to go on for a while yet, and I doubt they're going to really, you know, take charge of things while I'm here, so there's no sense getting out there and getting too many people killed if you didn't have to. Complete the mission, but make sure you take good care of your kids.
Good. Well, I'm sure that through the years, but from the time you went through your basic infantry course to now, you had a lot of time to look at what was working and what wasn't working leadership-wise.
Yeah, and the things that are in the book always aren't the best way to do things. And another problem that I saw at my level, and I hate to even say it, but it was the truth. We got a lot of higher level officers that were battalion commanders or, you know, operations officers that were senior majors and lieutenant colonels, and they came in after Korea, and they had never seen a shot fired in anger, had never really been in anything tricky, and were at the top of the power ladder, and thought they knew a lot, and maybe not quite as much as they thought they knew. Command and staff school, I guess, is great. But, you know, I learned an awful lot out there in the bushes, beating her down with a whole bunch of PFCs and Lance Corporal.
I wanted to circle back real quick. You talked about a lot of your folks were on their second tour. And this is really kind of a perspective question. I think a lot of it depends on what year you decide Vietnam actually started. But last year or the year before, they said Afghanistan has now actually become the long war, the one longer than Vietnam. And of course, we know folks that are probably on their third, maybe even their fourth or fifth rotations in Afghanistan. So if you could reach out to a new company commander in Kandahar or something like that, what advice would you have kid?
Listen to the people that have been there, that came home in one piece. You know, I sent you that little deal yesterday. I may not have a PhD, but I do have a DD-214.
Yep.
And if you're not in the military, you probably don't understand what that really means. But to you and I think we understand.
Yep.
And I ran into people all the time that I had known in 1962, 63, 64, and 65 that had been to Vietnam before. A lot of them had different jobs. Some of them were mortarmen. Some of them were rocketmen. Some guys were in 106s. Others were flamethrower guys, and a whole bunch were just grunts. And they were always willing to sit down and talk with me and allow me to pick their brain, and without actually knowing or studying, you pick up all of this stuff and you stick it back there so that when you see this same predicament beginning to happen, you kind of know what not to do. You may not know exactly what to do, but I've always been the kind of guy that I learned an awful lot more when things went haywire than I did if I did it right the first time.
Sure. There's no reason to learn the real hard lesson when someone else has already done it, right?
That's very, very true.
I wanted to ask you, real quick, going back to your company assignment, did you get a time to turn over with the company commander, with the previous company commander?
Oh, maybe a half a day.
Okay, so it was just kind of a high five. What was there a formal change of command that took place?
No, uh-uh.
Okay.
They just call you in and tell you, okay, you're going to go down and take over Bravo Company. You know, and we'll call Burl. I took over for a guy by the name of Burl Landis, and we'll call Burl and tell him you're coming. Well, of course, we were on the same in the same area at the time, so you know, you walk 100 feet, and there he is, and you know, he knows you're coming, and he's kind of happy to see you in a way, but then in another way, he's just disappointed, and he went up to be assistant operations officer, so that got him out of the field and in a little safer place. And so there's mixed emotions there, but he doesn't want to crunch in on me, and I don't want to steal any of his thunder.
Yeah. Well, I tell you, it sounds like the senior leadership is doing a lot of smart stuff, letting the new guy gain some situational awareness, bringing the other guys out of the field that are tactically smart, and bringing them up to
I think most of them understood that, and when it could happen, it did. But as you know, by looking at the rest of the year, 67 and 68, there were many things that happened where there was no, this is what's going on. Somebody just got grabbed from somewhere and they threw them right into the hornet's nest.
Well, that's a good statement. I was just getting ready to ask you a leading question. So you started off in the S2 shop. Now you've got your company, and we're coming up to January 1968, a fairly big event started at that point. So kind of a two-part question. When you were in the S2 shop, did you feel like the Tet Offensive was something that was building or in the making? And then once it happened, how did that impact you at the company?
Well, we had been, I'm talking 1-3 here, we had been up at an outpost, I believe it was called Alpha 3, and it was to the east of Tontien, and I believe we were up in there most of December, and we were basically laborers. We were building this position up. There were numerous bulldozers and graders, and you know, they were scraping off the dirt, and we were putting in barbed wire, and they were building these huge die marker bunkers. Because it was the civilian leadership at the time that thought that if the entire area along the DMZ was sprayed with Agent Orange and there was no foliage, you know, and we had these castle positions from one end to the other, that we could keep the North Vietnamese from invading the South. Well, I guess that was probably pretty good if you were back in 1780. But the rockets, the mortars, the artillery, they could all be fired from on the other side of the DMZ and they could hit us in our position. So we were constantly under threat of getting bombarded. And we tried to keep the noise down. That was one of the keys, was, hey, you guys do everything quiet so that you could hear the poop, 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 when they were shooting something at you, and you had time to dive in a hole somewhere. The hole was good if it landed near around you. If it landed right on top of you, it wasn't any good. But we were shot at, and course, all that started probably in July, back in July of 67. The NBA started raising hell along the DMZ. And, you know, they got 1-9 up there. They got 3-9. 1-3 was in up there on Buffalo. And, it just kept up until the build-up to Tet. And then Johnson and the Zip guy, they called timeout over Christmas and the Lunar New Year and all of that business. And we got orders. We did not shoot at anybody unless we were fired upon. That's kind of interesting watching 30 guys, 300 yards out in front of you, heading down somewhere, and you could do nothing because it was timeout. We weren't playing football at that point. For all we knew, they were going back to some hamlet or Quang Tree to visit relatives during the upcoming holiday. At least that's what we were told. So, we just sat there and watched things happen. And then, John, they did happen.
So did most folks think this ceasefire that led up to the Tet Offensive, did they think that would follow on with peace talks? I mean, did we feel like that was a critical junction in the war, that maybe we were going to finish this thing and go home?
I was at the low level. We all thought that was one hell of a mistake.
Yeah. Well, and of course it was, because look what happened in January. So, it's also interesting looking at your file. It looks like you transferred to 3-9. Then, so when Contine, is that when you did the unit transfer from to 3rd Battalion, 9 Marines?
The end of December, somebody else was assigned as the SLF. And I can't remember. I can't remember who that was. So they picked up the 911 quick action, quick reaction, whatever name we want to call it. They picked up that mission, and embarked out aboard the ship. And we moved back to Quang Tree and went in defense of the perimeter for the Quang Tree Air Base. So change of operational control, went from the Navy SLF commander back to the CG of the 3rd Marine Division. I think it was probably around the 1st or 2nd of January in 1968.
All right, so you went back to, so you're in a, so are these new guys, this is a new company?
No, it's it's the same outfit. We just had a different title. We still had the same number. We were 1st Battalion, 3rd Marines. We were no longer Battalion Landing Team, 1st Battalion, 3rd Marines. They took away our artillery. They took away the tanks. They took away the engineers. They took away all those dedicated assets that we had with us when we were embarked aboard the ship, in case, say, they wanted to haul us down to Saigon. Something happened down there. We could have steamed on down to southern Vietnam and made a landing down there. That didn't happen. They just changed. It was like transplacement battalion. We went from one designation to another, even though we were the same outfit.
And the primary mission, once you got moved back to Quang Tree, was to protect the air base?
Was to protect the air base.
Okay.
We were security for the air base. We patrolled all around the air base. And we were looking for people trying to sneak into the air base. And then, fortunately, on the 24th of January, I got transferred from 1st Battalion, 3rd Marines, over to the 3rd Marine Division. And I thought, oh, good. My time in the boondocks here is over. I'm going to go to 3rd Marine Division, live at the headquarters, you know, be the special services officer, you know, make the ice cream, something. And I walked in to see old John Angel, who was the adjutant, the 3rd Marine Division, and he said, hi, Tom, nice to see you. I'd like to talk to you, but there's a helicopter sitting out there. You jump on that baby, you're going to 3rd Battalion, 9th Marines. Oh, I went to the 3rd Battalion, 9th Marines.
So you didn't get a chance to come in and hang out and be the services guy. They just changed you back to, and so this is a whole new company.
Yep.
Okay, and that's Lima Company.
Yep, I went to Mike Company first. Because when I got there, the CEO of my company was on R&R with his wife in Hawaii, Richie O'Neill. And so they had three lieutenant platoon commanders, both second lieutenants, and the battalion commander wanted me to go down. And since I'd already had a company with 1-3, he wanted me to go down. I was never really assigned as the CEO of my company. I was just there. You know, they didn't have to do any paperwork that way. I was just there. We went out on a couple operations, and when we came back, and Rich came back from his R&R, and then I went over to Lima Company.
Okay. And what was Lima Company like when you got there? What kind of shape were they in?
I knew the CO, Sam Adams. He and I had a bunch of beers and went through some training together, you know, at Quantico, so I knew the guy that had been there. He was from Texas. And they had, they were all a little antsy because they'd just gone through an ambush on the 13th of January, where they lost a few guys, and that was still sticking in their craw.
So
you remember things like that, you know.
The company, I mean, Sam Adams, the company commander, he wasn't being replaced because of that or anything. It wasn't like a.
No, his time was up. He'd been there. Been there since July. He took over Lima Company right after they came back from Buffalo up by the DMZ.
Mm-hmm.
And if you ever get a chance and want to read some interesting stuff, just read about Buffalo a little bit. But no, he'd been the CEO since sometime in July, and this was January. And the S4, the log guy, was getting ready to rotate. And so they needed somebody in the log business that understood the battalion. And so he was going to be the S4. Generally, it was people that had been in the field for 3, 6, 8 months that took over, you know, those headquarters battalion type jobs other than the S2. You know, the S2, most of that intelligence, you didn't have anything to do with it at the battalion level. It all came down from up above. But the log stuff, the logistics, the operations, the administrative type things, that had to be people that understood what was going on in that battalion and not somebody from the outside that all they had was book learning.
So, with at Lima Company, is this still in the Quang Tree area?
No, we were out by the rock pile.
And where is that at?
Do you have a map in front of you?
No, I don't. You have to describe
it. Okay. Well, you go out from Quang Tree, Don Ha. you know, actually Quang Tree's a little south of Dong Ha, but from Quang Tree you run up north on Highway 1 till you hit Highway 9, and then you hook a left and you go past Dong Ha and Cam Lo, and then past Camp Carroll, and then you get out, you're heading into the mountains out there, and Highway 9 turns south, and right there where Highway 9 turns south, that's a base they call the Rock Pile. It's named the Rock Pile because of the huge rock formations that are out in that neck of the woods.
Okay, I think I do remember saying that. That was, I think somebody had mentioned once that it was called the Gibraltar of Vietnam or something because of the way that the spires.
Well, it's an amazing formation. You know, the Rock Pile there is just a big chunk of rock that sticks up and nothing on it but rock apes.
Now, how far is that from Quezon?
Well, it's actually maybe 10 miles, 12 miles. In those days, we thought it was forever. But when you go back and look at the maps, when you leave those places, you say, holy smokes, that was just down the road. I honestly can't answer in terms of mileage.
Huh.
It
was in the vicinity, I guess.
Used to take convoy security from the Rock Pile to Quezon, and we would do that in a day, and then we would escort the convoy back to the Rock Pile or LZ Stud or wherever it was going the next day. And we didn't go fast, and I used to like to walk. My guys used to hate me because they all thought we should be riding on these trucks. But maybe the guys in Iraq should have learned the same thing. I learned, boy, when you rode on those trucks and something went boom, you had no chance. If you were humping, you know, 30 feet off the road in brush, yeah, it was tough. But normally, you know, the bad guys got up and split before you got there because they weren't just going to pick you off and blow up a truck.
Let me ask you a little more about the Rock Pile. It wasn't like a combat base like Quezon was. It sounds like maybe it was more like an observation post.
Yeah, it was a smaller. We generally had at least two, sometimes three companies there. We were generally split between the Rock Pile and, if you head south on Highway 9, couple, 3-4 miles, Highway 9 turns right again and heads west out to Quezon. And at that turn, there was another little combat base that they called Kalu, C-A-L-U, capital C, small A, capital L, small U. And our battalion, when we were in those base positions, a lot of times we had two companies at the Rock Pile and two companies at Kalu. And then when the build-up to get ready to go in and take Quezon back in the spring of 68 was starting to take place, and the Army was moving equipment to LZ Stud, which later became Vandergrift Combat Base. Then we got pulled out of the Rock Pile and Kalu, and we were holding a lot of the bridges along Highway 9 so they didn't get blown up.
So this is still kind of out in bad guy country.
Yeah.
It sounds like there's a lot of movement through the area.
Yep, and there weren't a lot of friendlies out there either.
So you were sort of kept kind of mobile. You moved down here towards Vandergrift. You were in charge of protecting some of those lines of communication, like critical areas, like the bridges. And then what happened once the base was stood up and you know, the infrastructure got a little more proven, I guess. What was your role at that point?
Once Quezon was relieved, considered fairly safe again and wasn't under the threat of being overrun by NVA ground forces, then we went back to humping the hills around all of these areas north of Quezon, northwest of the rock pile, and north-northwest of Kowloon. There was a couple times we were right down on the border of Laos. We didn't even know we were there.
So it sounds like a lot of your missions were there to observe and report back, and if there was enemy activity, what did you do? Did you engage? Did you call in artillery?
We were looking and trying to pin down the bad guys and where they were moving things from. There was a lot of interest in finding the truck routes that they were using to move supplies south. And so we were out scouting the bushes all the time trying to find out where these roads were. I mean, we walked across one time and didn't find it until we came back. I mean, it was that well concealed. We found places where they had a lot of ammunition stored, and they would bring it down from the north and they would hide it in bunkers in the sides of these ridge lines. I think I sent you a picture of old Sergeant Goins putting rabbit ears on me.
Yep.
You know, when we came across a whole bunch of 122s one time, you know, stuffed in the side of a hill. And that's what we did. We were out allegedly closing with the enemy, searching out and closing with the enemy. If we did find them and we got in a shootout with them, we tried to hold our position and call in supporting arms. I didn't like the high diddle-diddle up the middle, charge, bayonets, hand grenades. I like sitting back there and, you know, letting somebody drop some 500-pounders and napalm them. That moved them out in a hurry.
Plus you got a free air show.
Yeah. If we could see it. Most of the time we were in triple canopy and you really couldn't tell what was going on. You knew what was going on right in front of you. But I mean, you know, when you guys hit the side of the hill and we didn't see it, you know, we didn't know. We just heard a big crawl.
So did that kind of stay your primary mission with Lima Company for most of your tour?
Yes. We were not stationary. Okay. We were constantly on the move as long as the weather didn't have us pinned down.
Did you have any times that they would let you sort of retrograde and come back and, you know, have a week off or anything and refit, get, you know, your equipment replaced or anything like that?
Not really. The softest time we had was when we were ripping Quezon apart.
So you didn't...
Probably about the end of June 1968. We got hauled in there to rip up the sandbags and, you know, throw the refuse and everything in the bunkers and dump the diesel on the bunkers and burn them down. And then when we left, it was basically graded and flapped and looked like a farmer's field, with the exception that we left the runway.
And that's because Vandegrift had taken over as the combat base.
That's right. That was the main combat and logistical base. Yep, they moved it east, and there was nobody sitting out there on top of Quezon anymore. People went in and out of there on a regular basis. But, you know, it didn't become the heavy hit in the 881 North and 881 South and 861 battles that had been going on, to know in 66 and 67.
And that kept you guys pretty much engaged, though. So no, you didn't get to see any of the big USO tours with Bob Hope and Ann Margaret or anything like that?
No.
Oh, that's a shame. Well, let me ask
you. We had names for those people, you know. those were the rents.
Yep.
Okay.
They still use that term today.
Yeah. Okay. So, no, we didn't, and that was okay.
Okay. So, June 68, moving down. I don't want to jump too far ahead, but I do want to talk about the 15th September 68. It was a Sunday, and I'm going to assume, based on what you just told me, you're still doing the same type of mission. Because I was able to find one of the battalion reports from Lima Company, and it looked like it was about mid-morning, 9:45 in the morning, 15 September, where you guys came in contact. Well, actually, it wasn't contact. It looked like it was a your point guy. And the point guy was Jimmy Bordeaux.
Yeah, Jimmy was a special case. Jimmy was an S2 scout, and Jimmy was really, as I recall, only in Nam because earlier in his Marine Corps career in Vietnam, he decided to stay down around Da Nang when he was on an R&R, and he stayed a little longer than he should have been. And he might have even been down there for about 6 months longer. So people kind of thought Jimmy had an attitude problem or whatever, and I knew the S2 at the time, and I said, hey, send him over to us. We'll take him. We can always use somebody. And so we had him with us, and he was pretty good. You know, he was a young guy, had full piss and vinegar, and he liked being out front. He liked being the scout. So we worked him like that for whenever he wanted to do it. We kind of like to keep people fresh and rotate them, but anytime Jimmy thought, well, I'd like to be up front today, we'd, okay. Go down with 3rd platoon and they want you up on point, you can go. You gotta understand what the ridgelines were like. They were very sharp, they weren't very wide. You might have had room at the top of them to go 3 or 4 people wide without dropping off the sides. So you didn't have this huge amount of people, you know, pushing forward up this ridgeline. It was only maybe a fire team up front. And you couldn't see much. You were in triple canopy woods. The NVA had green colored Claymore mines. A lot of them were electrically detonated, and it depended what you were running into as to whether they let the first, you know, 8 or 10 guys go by and then detonate one, or the guy got nervous when the first couple guys were coming up there and then they'd let it rip. And most of our casualties worked in those ridgelines were from small arms, machine gun fire, and those claymores going off. And it was close in, tough, brutal, nasty stuff.
So, and I think the term that, at least they use today, they call that command detonation.
Detonation.
So that's designed to let the, you know, like you said, observe until they put them in a certain position and then detonate. Now, what was that particular mine or meant to be command detonated, or were they normally?
Oh yeah, that's what they were intended for.
Okay.
Kind of just like ours.
Yep. And I think on the report it referenced something called a DH-10, which if I did my research right, is really designed more to wound than to kill, and cause the logistical tail to have to energize and bring in more people and medevac people and make for a better activity for them.
Yeah, and on this operation, which is one that we were going to be on 3 or 4 months earlier before things hit the fan, up around Dong Ha, there was a hospital complex in there. There was a big supply dump. I think if you're looking at that same monthly report in September of 68, somewhere in there they list, the thousands of mortar rounds, the thousands of recoil, 75 recoilless rifle rounds, the hand grenades, the small arms ammunition and machine gun ammunition, and the 81 mortar rounds that we dug out of those bunkers, on that ridge line. So, getting back to what you were saying, yes, they were designated, those DH-10s, to go off, knock everybody over that was up front, stop us in our tracks, drag our wounded back, knock out an LZ quick with some C4 and dynamite and chainsaws so we could get a 46 to drop down, get the wounded and the dead out, and then start moving forward again. That's kind of how we played it. And that allowed them a little bit of time to kind of get out of Dodge, too, I guess, if they wanted to.
So that was a typical troops in contact scenario, that something like that would happen. They'd wound a few people up front, cause all these activities to happen because they knew the way we would operate with our wounded, cause this skirmish and then try and evade out of the area.
It wasn't like when we were out on the flat in Leatherneck Square, where when you'd run into something, it would be a 3 or 4 or 5 hour affair and they'd try to come around your rear end and, where you were fighting them for 4 or 5 hours, and you ended up with 20 or 30 dead and 70 or 80 wounded. These were short, sweet, but very, very brutal.
Let me ask you one quick question about that. Looking at the battalion report, after it started about 9:45, it looked like, I assume these are local times, and the at one point, about an hour and a half or so later, there was a requested 106mm recoilless rifle and airstrike, and in parentheses says soft ordnance. What does that mean?
I believe instead of the fuses that went kaboom right away, I believe it allowed them to go into the, into the side of the hill and detonate, Once they were in the dirt and blow everything up, instead of, they had BT fuses and they had all these fuses they could set for different elevations and distances, and they could drop stuff over the top of you that would, go off at 15 feet in the air and everything would come down from above, and then they had other things that would go into the ground, and then we didn't want stuff that we used for bunker busting, because if you were going into concrete and things, the soft fuses, the soft ordnance didn't seem to work quite as well as the ones that bored right through the... I'm rusty on all that stuff
today. That's okay. I just, it was a curious note.
But I was an old 106 guy, if you go back and look at what we talked about when I was back in 17. And I had a 106 platoon with Flames and the 81s. And I knew what 106s could do, and the battalion was behind us. And they were above us. We were down in this saddle on this ridgeline, and we were trying to work our way up to the top of this ridge, and there was a bunker or two sitting up on top of that ridge, and they were throwing everything down at us. We couldn't go around the side. It was so steep that we were slipping and sliding. We tried that, and the hand grenades came down from the top. Two of them hit me in the shoulder. Unfortunately, it was very wet and rainy, and, you know, they didn't go off. But so I asked Frankie Brass, who was the ops officer, if he could get us a couple of 106s in there, and I put the air panels on, and they could see us, and we could walk that ordnance right up the hill into that bunker complex and just blow them right off the top. So it took us an hour or so. We recovered our wounded and our two dead. The engineer boys that we had with us strapped some C4 around some tree stumps and blew a hole big enough so that the bird could hang above us and drop a line down. And we wenched out, you know, the wounded and our two. I think we probably had three KIAs that day: Riley, Jimmy Bordeaux, and Vinny Wargo. So we winched those guys out. By the time all of that was done, the 106s were set up. We had comm with them, and it was just like being on an exercise at Camp Pendleton, California. Hey, boys, can you see me up here? Yep, we gotcha. Okay, I'd like to fire that spotting rifle, which was Willie Peter. And we could see where that spotting rifle hit, and we just worked them right up the ridge till they got to the bunkers. And then we said, okay, let them have it. And they flipped a few rounds, I can't remember how many. And they took off very neatly, you know, those bunkers and a lot of the top of that ridge line. And an hour later, we were standing on top of the ridge in one piece, and nobody got hurt.
So, Jimmy Bordeaux, your S2 guy that came over, he was killed
initially right off the bat.
And Vinny Wargo wanted to recover him. Is that
what he did? Riley and Jimmy, you know, were dead right now. You know, they frankly never knew what hit them. Okay, I mean, there was no suffering. They were just boom boom, and it was over. And Wargo went up to get him, wanted to try to get him back, and he got shot in the chest. And we managed to get him back. But the blood was, you know, things were just went the way they went, and he didn't make it.
And I saw when I was looking at on another document, not the ones that we had here at Texas Tech, but that Vinny Wargo was put in for and received the Silver Star for that action. Is that true?
He did.
Excellent.
It was a killer for me personally. I mean, that one hurt. They all hurt, but Vinny getting killed really hurt, because he was from down there by Philly. We would sit and talk about the things that went on in Philly. I sent him home probably a month before he got killed, because one of his sisters died in a car accident. So we sent him home to go to the funeral. He came back from that and joined us out there, and then it wasn't but a couple of weeks later, and he was dead, and we were sending his body back home. And his dad was a medic with the Army at Fort Dix. And the first sergeant, Bob O'Donnell, was from Reading, Pennsylvania. And we made sure we went through all his personal belongings, and we took out everything that was really personal, and we kept it. And we sent the rest of the stuff through the system. And when Bob O'Donnell rotated, he carried Vinny's diary and a few other items that were very, very personal, and took them and delivered them to his father at Fort Dix.
Wow.
And we had a reunion last month in Gettysburg. And two of Vinny's sisters were there. And it was a pretty emotional time for both of them, because they got the opportunity to sit down with Mad Dog Moore, the lieutenant, JAG type, who was right there with Vinny when he died. And, you know, so they got to hear the real personal stuff, and I think it was pretty tough on Mary Ellen, the older of the two.
Well, that's
40 some years later. So
I bet it probably was very emotional, but I bet afterwards they were. That was some incredible information, and to refresh that in their minds, I bet they appreciated hearing all that. But you know, in the end.
Yeah, it's, I don't know, I guess it can be a good deal or a bad deal. I've been involved in several things that, you know, where I was with a family that somebody died, and some go one way, and they're appreciative and they enjoy it, in that they understand the circumstances, and even though it's very emotional. And then I know others where, you know, they don't even want to see you, don't want to have anything to do with you. And I understand that. I've never pushed the issue.
All right. Well, I appreciate you talking about 15 September. It was nice to be able to see, to be able to pull the battalion report. And I know that was important to you because of your file, of what you'd written. So I appreciate you doing that. I'd like to come back a little bit to your... That was in September, halfway through your, so you're 45 days out from the end of your tour. So what's happening now? What's going on? Are you becoming a short timer?
Never thought about it. You know, you never thought about that. I'm getting close, because every time you did, something nasty seemed to happen. So you just kind of, okay, this morning, it's raining, I got to put the poncho on, I'm going to be slipping in the mud. It's a nice, bright, sunshiny day. Gee, we can take some of these things off. Maybe we can dry out a little today. I tried not to get too far ahead.
One day at a time.
It was kind of hard on the head if you did that. You start thinking, and I mean, I got into the end of August, and I don't know where we were sitting, but we were somewhere, and... the mortar guys were firing, you know, and they dropped the short round right by my left foot and buried into the dirt. You know, and without thinking, I just reached down, picked it up, burned my hand. You know, was really pissed because it was only 6 inches away from my left foot. I was shaving at the time. Picked it up, took it over to give it to old Ed Strasser, a gunnery sergeant, and he was with me back in 1-1 and 2-9 back in 62-63, old Ed, here's a mortar round for you, Ed, why don't you stick this up your ass sideways, you know? And I turned around to start walk back, and my knees just started shaking. I could barely make it, and they said I had turned completely white. hadn't been on R&R. I'd been in country there since October, and I hadn't been on R&R, so the boss said, you get out of here, go on an R&R. So I did, and it was a nice 6 or 7 day break.
So you did that in September or October?
Probably late August.
Oh, late August, okay. And then you got back in, had your mission on 15 September, of course, and then,
yeah.
So tell me about the last 45 days. Anything significant go through your mind for the last 45 days of being with 3-9 or Limicum?
It rained. And we had all these briefings, and we were going to do this and going to do that. And we were sitting there at LZ Stud in the rain, providing, you know, security for the combat base, just getting wetter and wetter. And it's amazing how cold you can get when it's 70 degrees, you know, and your hide is shriveled. By that time, I was down to about 145 pounds. I went over weighing about 200. I'd been wounded twice. The second one was really just a nick, enough to draw some blood and get the corpsman nervous. The first one had me in the hospital about 10 days. And you're just wet and miserable. I mean, it was just, here we go again. I know what September and October were like. I was sitting up on the DMZ last October and November a year ago, and it rained and rained and rained. And nobody's flying. Helicopters don't fly. Fixed wing aren't flying. The clouds are overhead. You're socked in. It's hard to keep ammo dry. It's hard to keep yourself dry. It's hard to get rations and water because nobody's flying. And we were walking. It was a miserable time. And I didn't want to think about going home. In my mind, I had this, I do not want to think about going home and being one of those guys that you hear about that had 3 days to do, you know, and caught one.
Yep. Audie Murphy style.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, of course, you get to the middle of October, and you're getting this rotation. Can you walk us through that just a little bit? Was it just as chaotic as in processing, or was it a little different process leaving?
It was miserable. We had the skies clear for a couple of days, so God bless them. Division and the regimental headquarters sent us down into the mountaintops in the Balong Valley, south of Vandergrift. So we're sitting up there in the clouds again, and everything closes in on us. Comes the 1st of October or so, some new captain arrives. The boss says to me, you're coming up here to the battalion CP. You're going to be the special projects officer. And I watched this captain come in, and I didn't know the guy. I didn't really trust anybody taking over the outfit, you know, with the procedures and the methods that we had developed over the previous 7, 8, 9 months. I was fairly happy to be scheduled to go home, but I was very torn about leaving. Those were my brothers. Those were the people that shared my water, my feed, my bullets, my happy times, my sad times, my hurts, my joys. And I just, there were points I really didn't want to leave them. But I knew if I didn't, you know, I wasn't going to get home. The odds are, if you're there too long, something's going to happen and you're not going to make it. And I didn't want to live.
So, did they take you back to Da Nang?
I sat there in the rain because they couldn't get a helicopter in. And then one day there was an army slick flying around and they heard him. And somehow we got him on the radio. He came down. I left everything I had right there, jumped on the helicopter. They were full. The guy said, I think we can get out of here. And I sat on my feet were on the skids, and they put a sling around my waist and tied me, you know, in the door jam, and away they went. And we landed in Quang Tri, and the first sergeant somehow knew I was coming in, and we landed there, and I said, you boys sit right here a minute, will you? And the old first sergeant was standing there when we got in, and I said, Bob, there's four crewmen on that. I need four bottles of whiskey. He said, we got it. So he went back real quick, and I was a wild turkey drinker in those days, and we gave the four crew members on that army slick each a bottle of wild turkey, and I kind of shook their hands and said, thank you, and away they went.
I'll be darned. I wonder, have you ever met any of those guys since then?
No,
I doubt it.
I didn't know who their name, you know, they didn't care either. They were, you know, they were like you, John. They were going from one place to another. They stopped down, did a good deed, went on down the line, and that was it.
Yeah. Well, okay, so you get there, and I guess eventually you got an ability now to get back to the wherever the rotator is with the Freedom Bird. Or
yep, I got down to, I spent a night with the boys in Quang Tri, reminiscing, talking. The first sergeant gave me a bag of trinkets, NVA belts, buckles, you know, little hats, soft cover hats and stuff, because I didn't have any money. And he said, you get down there. And I said, yeah, I get down to Da Nang. I can find somebody I know. They'll throw me in a hooch, you know. So I got down, I went into the second wing club, and one of my old buddies was there, Dennis Damon, and he said, you can stay in our hooch. And there was a colonel that had been the intelligence officer, was there, and I sat down and talked with him, and he was real interested in getting a couple trinkets to take home. I said, you buy me beer tonight? You meet me at the hospital tomorrow, and I'll give you anything you want in that bag. So we had a few beers, and I got kind of rowdy. And the next morning outside the hospital, there was three air wing colonels there, because I had berated them the previous evening about not visiting the troops in the hospital. None of them had even been inside the hospital. No, so I talked about the boys and the grunts and the ones that are guarding your base, so you can have your steak and your ice cream and your music and your USO show. And while you're doing that, these guys are out here on the line, and they don't ever get to see this stuff. So we went through the hospital, and they were quite taken aback. Now these are guys that have been in the Marine Corps a long time, bird colonels in the air wing. they had seen airplane crashes and how they were talking to these PSCs and Lance Corporals that were scared to death. They were in the hospital. They didn't know where they were going. They didn't know if they were going to live. They didn't know if their mother knew what happened. And so these guys from the wing headquarters there, they just jumped right in, took names and their mama's phone numbers and stuff like that. And, you know, called the parents at home and said, I've spoken with your son. He's here. No matter what anybody comes to your door and tells you or wherever you get phone calls, I talked to him this morning. You know, when they gave him the firsthand scoop on what was happening, and I left and went down and caught the bird to Okinawa and got off and went to the transient barracks. Spent, I think, 2 days in Okinawa before I had a flight back to whatever the Air Force base is out there by Bakersfield.
Then
I jumped on that bird going to Bakersfield, got off there, they processed me out, got a couple of bucks in my pocket, got a bus ride to the LA International Airport, and somewhere between Bakersfield and the LA International Airport, the air, the atmosphere around us turned kind of a dingy yellow. And we all looked at each other and said, yep, we're back in the States. So everything we went through over there, the air was clean. The air was breathable. There was no pollution. High metallic content every once in a while, but you know, there it was. There was LA down there in the basin, and the air was just stinky. Got off the bus. The cops were there at the bus. Said, people are going to harangue you. They're going to throw things at you, which they did.
You were in uniform.
And he said, but if you get in a fight, you're going to be the one going to jail. So maintain your composure, boys. So I did. Got in the airport, got my ticket on American Airlines, straight flight to Philadelphia. Had a few beers, probably had more than a few. Got on the airplane, and I think I probably slept almost the whole way to Philadelphia. Got off in Philly, and there was my brother and sister-in-law waiting for me.
And
so now I was back in the States.
Awesome. And you were in uniform during this trip?
Yes.
And I just want to ask a quick question. So you said you did have people approach you, I assume some kind of an anti-military statement
or
something.
Yeah. I thought I was dirty and scuzzy when I was in Vietnam, but these were some of the dirtiest, scuzziest people, you know, I'd ever seen.
Was this at the LA airport or the Philly airport?
LA airport.
Huh.
There was nothing around in Philly. I think in LA they knew, you know, every hour on the hour, here comes a busload of people. You know, when they left us off at about the same, I was led to believe all the buses stopped at one place. And then they went around the building and dropped you off, you know, where you had your ticket on your flight. Because they gave us those vouchers for the tickets out at whatever that airbase was by Bakersfield. Because those were all civilian flights we were on coming in and out.
Right. Well, that's interesting. It's always interesting to hear people's reception that they got back. Okay, so your brother and sister-in-law pick you up in Philly. I assume they're going to take you on to see mom and dad.
Yeah, I stayed with my brother and I stayed with my brother and sister in Philadelphia for a day or two. And I don't know what day I got into Philly. My brother knew some people, and a guy was having a little party. And so, you know, I went to this party, and there was a, I didn't have a car or anything, but one of his bridesmaids from the previous year, you know, who went to Temple or had graduated from Temple University, she came over, picked me up, and said, here, I'll go with you into Philly. And so she drove me around Philly, and we went here and there, and I went to this little party, you know, and I was extremely uncomfortable. I didn't want to be there very long. You know, I did my, you know, here I am, shake hands, talk, you know, had a couple of drinks, and then, you know, let's get the hell out of here and go get a burger or something. And she took me back up North Philly to my brother's place. And within a day or so, my dad came down and got me, and we went back up to Palmerton, Pennsylvania.
So, just your dad to pick you up in Philly?
I think my mom came down too. I really don't remember that much.
Yeah.
I just knew. You know, I was home. I'd been at my brother's. Decompression had taken place. Car doors were still loud, and you'd jump. You know, that old routine, you know, that you hear everybody.
Yeah.
You know, if there was a bang or somebody dropped a box or, you know, holy smokes, you know, you turned and you know, it took a while before you know, got a little loose around the edges where you didn't jump at the first sound of everything.
Yeah. I wanted to circle back to this with your dad because he was a paratrooper in World War II. He told me he was, you know, part of the occupying force in Japan after the hostilities ended. I was just curious. Do you feel like your relationship changed a little bit when you came back?
I think it had changed when I was leaving. It's the only time I ever saw my dad with a tear in his eye. You know, he was having a hard time holding it together just before I got on the airplane, you know, heading to California, you know, to check in. And when I got home, he was, you know, calm, cool, and collected again. Glad to see you. Glad you made it. Told me a couple of stories about things that happened when I was in the hospital in the first week of May. One of my old college buddies was a captain in the Marine Corps, communicator type. He was stationed with a reserve unit in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. And one of the WIA lists came across his desk. And he got in a sedan with one of his buddies, and they headed up to Palmerton, and he said, I just want to stop by and tell Ira that Tom was hurt, but that he's going to be fine. And, because he knew my dad from when we were in college.
Right.
And my dad was teaching school, and my mother was home alone, and the Marine Corps sedan pulled in front of the house. Yeah, and of course, everybody in the world, now you're in this little town, you know, everybody in the world knows who lives there, and they know what the Marine Corps sedan means, you know. And my mother was the only smart one. She said, there's Mike, and there's no preacher with him. The priest from St. Aloysius is not there. So something not so good happened, you know, but he's not dead, as they always send the priest on the notification. So she invited Mike and the staff sergeant in, and she called my dad in at the office. They didn't have phones in the room or cell phones or any of that, you know. She called the office and told Tootsie Olivia that but she go down and tell my dad to come home that there's Marines here. So, she told him just enough to get it rolling again in the high school. And, of course, my dad came home. He didn't know nothing other than there were Marines at the house. And he walked in, and, of course, there was Mike Connie, the staff sergeant. And like you said, he told him, Ira, he's okay. He's just, he got some holes in him, but he's okay. So they had lunch and this and that, and I can remember them telling me that my dad shook his hand and said, Mike, don't take this personal. I don't want to see you again. You know, and that was how that went. But I was home then, and, you know, put on my blue jeans and a shirt, and, you know, I go hang out with a couple of guys I knew that were around town or passing through or whatever. We'd have a couple beers at the local joint and shoot some pool. And you know, I told my mom and dad, I don't want anything special. I don't want any gathering. I just want to kind of be left alone to go do what I want to do, you know, until it's time to go. And so they said, okay. And that was pretty much the way it was. People would come by. My dad would say, well, so-and-so, you know, your football coach wants to come down and see you tonight. Yeah, I'll be here, you know. But there was no big ruckus or anything.
Yeah. Well, and now you stayed on active duty, so you were just kind of having your 30 days leave or something?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I had a leave before I was reporting to Quantico.
Okay.
And I was kind of dreading that because I had a pretty good idea what they wanted me to do in Quantico.
What was that?
And I really didn't want any part of it. You know, it would have been fine with me if they sent me to the base stables to take care of the horses and, you know, just shovel out the pens. And I really just wanted off the skyline. But I reported in there, and there's old Hank Bodziak from 2nd Marine Air Wing, knew him. He was adjutant, and I was going out to the basic school. I was going to be a training officer for training 2nd Lieutenants. I said, I really don't want to do that. And he said, you know, it really doesn't matter what you want to do. Take a look at your record book. Take a look at the medals. Take a look at the awards. There's two sitting here for you when you get out there. You know, this, that, and the other thing. And I said, you know, Hank, I really don't want that. He said, I can't do a damn thing about it. You're going, that's it, Tom. So that night, you know, I had a couple of beers with Hank at the BOQ. And we sat there and sang a couple old country songs that we used to sing at Terry Point. And the next morning I reported in to the colonel at the basic school, Quantico, Virginia, Camp Barrett. And I was there for about 2 years.
1970. All right, and then
I didn't want to be there. You already got that.
Well, I could see that why the Marine Corps wanted you there. That makes sense. It sounds like that's who I would want to put there to train these young guys that are probably heading back to where you just came from. So.
Well, you know, the things that went through my mind was I was a captain. I had a lot of lieutenants. You know, I had Georgie Norris in Bravo 1-3. He was dead. I had Tommy Keppen in Bravo 1-3, and he was dead. And I had Mick O'Dell in Bravo 1-3, and he was dead. And, I had P.J. Harrington in Lima 1-3, and he was dead. And I had Jimmy Klein, you know, and he was medevaced out, and I got no idea where he is. You know, and and Ron Lanza was medevaced out, and I have no idea where he is. And these things go through your mind, and it's just like, you know, I really don't want to do this again. I just, you know, I kind of had my belly full of it, but I didn't have any choice. You know, I was on active duty. I was a regular. You know, I said, when can I put in for release from active duty? And they said, as long as this, you know, draft is on and these War Powers Acts or whatever they had that Johnson signed her in, you know, you're not going anywhere. You serve at the discretion of the President of the United States. So, you know, I said, okay, well, that's it. Here we go.
So you finally got your head around that and off you went. All right. And then...
Well, it's a big change. It was one heck of a change coming out of getting shot at one day, and the next day you're standing there on the street corner, people throwing stuff at you. You know? You baby killer, you no good SOB, you... Yeah, okay. No, it's kind of a whack in the head, you know? You got 250 guys with you, and they're all happy to be there with you. They may not be happy to be where they are, but they, you know, I never had any problems. I heard about people that, oh, my God, they wanted to frag this guy and frag. I never had any problems. And to this day, you know, they all come see me if they're in the neck of the woods. I stop to see them if I'm anywhere near them. You know, God, I go through a town. There's a couple towns to go through in Indiana, and there's five or six of them around, and I tell them, I'm in town. I'll see you tomorrow morning at the Cracker Barrel if you can make it. Hell, we got 10 guys at the Cracker Barrel, you know? So it's not like, you know, there's a lot of hate and bad feelings left or in the air. It's, we all kind of get along.
Well, what happened after Quantico?
After Quantico, I went down to the Marine Corps Development Center, and they put me in charge of several projects. One was the sniper rifle, another was the M48 grenade launcher. They were doing a live test on a range, and the other one that I had was night sights and night division devices. And so that was kind of interesting. You know, I got a chance to look at those things and be part of where that was going and give my two cents, even though it was, you know, commercial development.
Well, that's so you went through training, and then you were about 2 years at Quantico?
Yeah, I was just short of three.
Okay, so around 1973, you're over here in this acquisition area then, it sounds like.
I think I was in this acquisition area. Let's see, I got to Quantico in 68, probably end of October, November. You know, and I was there at the basic school for three companies, and I guess I left. Yeah. Well, I know in 19... probably about March of 1971, I got pulled out of the development center, and I was sent to Amphibious Warfare School, which was at Quantico. I think they needed a seat filler. You know, they had these seats and these instructional courses, and, you know, I think they needed a seat filler. And it was 1971, and I was already there. So lo and behold, they sent me to this amphibious warfare school.
Okay.
And we had some guys that later turned out to be famous in the class. But when that was over, I got sent back to 3rd Marine Division. While I was in the school, I got selected for major. which surprised me and half the other world. Because I had kind of a colorful career, off base.
So in 1971, you were selected for major.
1971, I was selected.
Wow, all right. Well, that's about on time, I think. It sounds like it's about when they would normally do that.
No, I think it was on time. During that period, however, there was a whole bunch of people that really got promoted earlier than what people are used to today. You know, I got promoted pretty much right on time going up the line.
Well, I guess
there were a whole lot of people that made captain a lot quicker and major a lot quicker, you know, because the Marine Corps was so much bigger. And when I got selected for major, I actually passed quite a few people that were already major. But they were, quote, temporaries. And when the permanent selection came around, for some reason or other, they didn't make it. And I did. And I always attributed that to I was being graded as a captain the whole time. You know, and I was up against, my competition was guys that had been a captain for a year and a half or 2 years.
Right.
And you better have learned a little bit more about a lot of things, you know, in those extra 4 years or whatever it was.
So I guess you had to make a decision that whether you were going to stay in or make this a career at this point.
Well, once I knew I was selected for major, I said, I'm guaranteed 20 years now.
So that made
that
you...
That was how I made my decision, John.
Okay, that's what I was going to ask. Well, and, you know, we're 1971, we're into the Vietnamization of the war and trying to back out of that. So we're real close to what we used to refer to as the Vietnam drawdown. There's going to be a massive reduction in the Marine Corps here pretty soon.
Yep. And there was.
How did that affect things?
That's what surprised me about making major. We knew that drawdown was coming. So, I mean, it's kind of what everybody was talking about. Marine Corps grunts, most of them were out of Vietnam in late, you know, summer to late 69. They were all back on Okinawa and Camp Pendleton, California. You know, and there I was, I got selected, I don't know, must have been April of 71. Normally the selection boards met in the early spring. So there I was, I got selected for major, and here's all these guys that were majors that didn't get selected. And I got selected on the permanent board, and they got missed on the permanent board.
So somehow you were living right.
Remember I told you I've been lucky my whole life?
Well, so you've become a field grade officer.
Oh, boy.
You're about halfway through your career. What happened? What's the highlight between here and June of 83?
Well, I went out to 3rd Marine Division, and I went to 3rd Recon Battalion, which was, you know, kind of a hoity-toity outfit, you know, so to speak. I don't mean, I'm not using the right word, but, you know, it was one of those considered quite an organization, and if you couldn't make it into that. So I was the ops officer for 3rd Recon Battalion. I did a year there. I went down to Parris Island, South Carolina. I was an operations officer at the headquarters with my old regimental commander, Robert H. Farrow, as the CG. And for the next bunch of years, wherever Bobby Farrow went, I seemed to follow, which was a nice feeling. I did my, 72 to 75 at Barrow's Island. Barrow went to Norfolk at FMF Lant, and I went to FMF Lant as the NATO operations officer. Now, my goodness, what was NATO? I had no idea. Absolutely none. You know, there were no Marines in Europe other than the guys guarding the embassy. So I had to learn a whole new side of the Marine Corps, the Defense Department, the European system, the Air Force stuff. They owned all the airspace. Had to reintroduce them to the fact that, no, when there's an amphibious landing taking place, the Navy guy controls the airspace over the TAOR until the forces are aground and the landing has been considered complete. That used to get me in hot water with a lot of people. But I'd say, go back and read your manual. So there were a bunch of those things that happened. I spent time in Norway. That was enjoyable. We were watching Ivan, coming out of Murmansk and sailing ships up there around Kristiansand. And you could see that they didn't have much left. The ships were in a state of disrepair, and the tanks sitting on the deck, you could look at them and see they weren't so hot. We did exercises in the North Atlantic, the Shetland Islands. I learned about GPS guidance submarines. I learned a lot of stuff that, I had no idea was even out there. At the end of 4 years or so doing that, I became the XO for Headquarters Battalion in Norfolk. And after that, I went to my retirement position at the Military Enlistment Processing Command, which was at Fort Sheridan in Illinois and Great Lakes, Illinois. By then, I had made my mind up, I'm leaving. It was the 80s, and I could see what was coming. Carter had been the president. Marines were still held captive in Tehran. Every time we tried something, it was botched because things had to be politically correct. Everyone had to have a piece of the action. The Army, the Navy, the Air Force, the Marines, the National Guard, the Reserves, everybody had to be in on it. And it just, it wasn't a good deal, John.
So you knew that it was probably time to go do something else about that
point. Yeah, I knew that until something started up again, it was going to be, you better look at the brass on your belt buckle and you better not fart in front of the Queen. all of those things that we seem to fall back on, that they lose track of when you're in war, but they are required and highly visible when you're in peacetime. And it's the same thing that caused us grief when we were company officers in a war zone, and we'd get these guys that were lieutenant colonels and majors that had never seen anything, and now they were the battalion commander.
Yeah.
Importance, common sense, you can block out anything I say that you don't like.
Well, I want to circle out one more thing. Somewhere in this time frame, you met a young lady and decided to make another life together. When did that happen?
I met this gal when I was probably at Cherry Point. She was getting divorced, had two kids. You know, I was a single guy running around. I'd bump into her here and there. You know, took the kids to the beach, played in the sand, things like that. I went off to Vietnam, came back. While I was over in Vietnam, you know, she was writing letters, and I would write back, again, trying not to, you know, say one thing or another. And going along with that, coming back and going to Quantico and not wanting to be out there teaching lieutenants how to fight a war was this desire to just, instead of living in BOQs and BOQ bars and TV sets, you know, in bars, and I wanted a place where I could sit down, have a home-cooked meal, and just kind of get away from it all. So, in, it was, must have been November 1968, right before I got into the real swing of things at Quantico, I made a jump and got married in Arlington, Virginia, in front of the Justice of the Peace.
And you did that in November of 68.
Yeah, November of 68.
Right.
And it was one of those moves that I got right down to, you know, 3 minutes before I was doing it, and I was ready to bail. I said, whoops, this is permanent. Do I really want to do this? But I did, and I stayed married until 1998. There was a total of four kids involved, two that came with the package, and two that we had, a son and a daughter. And then I was in raising reindeer in northern Minnesota, and one day I came home from being on the road making some bucks out there with the reindeer, and drove in the driveway and put the reindeer back in the pen, unhooked the trailer, walked in the house, and after a short hello, how are you conversation, she mentioned to me that she thought maybe it would be best if I didn't live there anymore. And I looked the kind of square in the eye, and she looked me kind of square in the eye. I said, Ellie, say what you mean and mean what you say. And she looked me back in the eye and said, I don't think you should be living here anymore. So, a couple of days later, I got back in my trunk, went to the Bronx Zoo, picked up the 8 deer I had in there, came back, dropped them. I knew what was coming, so I dropped them at another place that was on my list where I could park them without getting in legal trouble with the game wardens and the Department of Agriculture and everybody else. And I headed back up north and stopped at the bank to put some money in, and, you know, I found out that things were going to turn pleasant to, you know, confrontational fairly soon. So I went to see a lawyer, and he said, let me call the sheriff, and he called the sheriff, and the sheriff said, we have a protection warrant to issue to him, and he said, he's here in the office, so come on up and give it to him. So then I had to go through the court system and all of that business, and it was, I had never done anything. I never, you know, raised my voice, threatened anybody. But because I was a Marine, because I was in combat, because this, that, and the other thing, you know, I was a threat. I could go hyper, but I, you know, I said, nope, I don't have any reason to do anything. You know? But that was that. So I was lucky enough that I knew I could see what was coming after she told me I didn't want to. And there started a new bank account with the same bank, called the Marine Corps. They moved my retired check from a joint account to my bank account. And then it was on with the lawyers and the judge.
Oh, man. Well.
And you know how those go.
Yeah.
You've heard enough of them.
Well, I tell you what, thank you for providing that. And, you know, we just went through a great career here and talked a little bit about your life after the Marine Corps. Anything else you want to talk about?
No, I moved from where we just quit into the reindeer raising business. I was told I don't think you should live here anymore, so I went down to Wisconsin, found another farm, you know, took my reindeer after all the legal wrangling and stuff that goes on, took all my reindeer, all of the things that were mine, and started again in, you know, 1998 in Milltown, Wisconsin, and had a reindeer farm until 1970, when I was 70 years old, and it was just getting tough. And so then I actually really, really retired and jumped in a truck and a trailer and drove around the country, and I kind of settled in Florida and linked up with a gal that I knew from Philadelphia in the 60s. Okay, and we're parked down here in Hernando Beach and living happy and having a good time.
Good. Well, good for you. I think you earned it. And I would like to tell you, just for the record while we're recording, I can't tell you how much I've enjoyed the time that we put in to research your unit activities, research a little bit of your life, and I thank you for allowing us to document this and put this in the archives.
It's my pleasure. You know, it is what it is, John.